So welcome all to this technical committee, our first meeting for the year. I hope you all had a relaxing festive season, and we look forward to your contribution today. We have no apologies, there is no advisory leave of absence, attendance in terms of staff. I will leave that until the items that pop up and just introduce the staff as each of those items. Confirmation of the agenda, no changes for any reason such as urgency. Conflict of interest, the standard comment there with regards to your awareness, if there is a need to make a declaration. The confirmation of minutes, these are the minutes of the meeting held on the 29th of November 2017, and I will move that they be received and confirmed as a true and accurate record. Just we'll test the system. Ella, would you like to second that, please?
Yes,
thank you. Any discussion? If not, I'll put the motion. All those in favour, please say aye.
Aye.
Against, carried. We have no public forum. We have no presentations. And just for our noting, item 9, the actions, which is on the agenda today, the report with regards to the reduction of use of coal achieved from Dr. Mills, which we'll discuss later on. So moving on to the first item, we have the Dr. Palmer's report. It's quite a lengthy report, covers off numerous topics, some weather events, and lots of other items as well. What I suggest we do is we just work through, I think there's 17 topics, we'll just work our way through, starting with the climate and river flow and groundwater situation. So is there any comment or question? It's rather ironic that we're dealing with this in light of the challenging summer conditions we have and the current forecast for quite a stormy 24-48 hours on the horizon as well. So question for Gavin really is around the information we received from NIWA. What is there, I suppose, more detailed information on a sub-regional basis that we receive, or is this pretty much it, Gavin? Is that question?
Through you, Mr. Chairman, this is pretty much the best we can get from NIWA, but Dr. Olson might like to comment on anything else we might be able to get at that sub-regional scale.
Yeah, can you hear me, Councillor Lawton? Okay, I'll try my best. So in figure one and also figure two, figure one, the middle map there is the rainfall anomaly. So NIWA is essentially standardising, it's representing the deviation from what you would normally expect for the region. So that takes into account regional variation in rainfall. So if you may well expect an area that is wet to show up, it'll show up in the actual rainfall figures as being having higher rainfall as some of the drier areas, but that middle graph is really showing the anomaly, so it's the deviation from that normal expected rainfall. Also in figure two, you've got the 30-day and 60-day standardised precipitation index. Now that does the same sort of thing. That is essentially the deviation from what you would normally expect for a site. So it does take into account the variation within the region.
Thank you, Dr. Olson. Queries? Councillor Scott.
Yeah, East Otago. I was just a bit surprised that rainfall totals are about equally likely to be in the near 35% to above normal 40% range this time of the year. I'm not 100% sure what that means, but is there expected to be more rainfall in this period than typical? Certainly, January's been pretty light. Is it from dump to dump, and the total stays the same?
Dr. Olsen?
Dr. Olsen.
Those projections from NIWA are just probabilities. You'll see that they're quite often, all the numbers are quite high for each of the possibilities. My understanding is that, you know, if they didn't know essentially what was going to eventuate, you would see around about 33% for each of the probabilities, and any deviation from that 33, a change by 5% is deemed to be significant. So I definitely take the point that they have been projecting near normal to normal rainfall, and we certainly haven't seen that. I guess with Western Otago, taking Western Otago, for example, you've got a 75% chance of it being near normal or above normal. Well, that still leaves a 25% chance of it being less than normal. So this is the difference between, climate predictions and the actual weather.
Oh, I see. Is it a 35% chance to be above normal? Is that what that says?
Sorry, for Eastern Otago, it is saying there's a 35% chance of it being near normal and a 40% chance of it being above normal. But I think what we're seeing at the moment is the 25% chance of it being below normal is actually what we're getting.
Okay. Thank you.
Any further questions, queries? Everyone quite comfortable? Moving, and after saying Dr. Olsen, I was going to introduce each staff member as I failed to notice you coming up to the table. But Dr. Olsen, of course, is our manager, Resource Science. So welcome along. Moving on to item 3, Lake Snow Investigations. Sort of fine-tuning the focus. Dr. Olsen, was there anything you wanted to comment on there?
Not really, other than these were identified by the experts' workshop held at the end of the year before last. These were identified as being the high priority items for further investigation. So.
Thank you. Queries, questions? Quite comfortable? Okay, moving on. Oh yes, Ella. Oh, sorry, Councillor Lawton.
Wondering on any information on current changes to Lake Snow with the warmer weather that we're experiencing in the lake. Have we got any data to show variance, or have we heard anything from Queensland Lake to Council about the impact on the infrastructure?
Dr. Olsen.
So the feedback that we have had has actually come through members of the public. Certainly in Lake Wakatipu, in the Kingston Arm, the feedback is that it has become particularly bad in recent weeks. We've also got some citizen science work that's being done through the Touchstone Project, and as part of that, they're looking at Lake Snow. And they're looking to expand that work further. And from that work as well, the suggestion is that it seems to be getting particularly bad at the moment. So I think typically from previous years, February, March, April typically is the worst part of the year for Lake Snow, so it's not abnormal in that regard, but I haven't heard anything specific from QLDC regarding this year being exceptional at this stage.
Thank you.
It would be great to have some way of quantitating the amount of differences in the season and
the weather. Yeah, so at the moment with the technology available, We don't have a means of putting a sensor down to, that is specific to lake snow. Our best method at the moment is are the snow tows that we're doing. So we're putting a downrigger all down to a set depth and towing it at a set speed over a set distance and then collecting the material and getting that that biomass from the downrigger line. That's ongoing, so that's happening every month that we're out doing the trophic lake monitoring. In terms of a sensor, the council will remember that there was an update a while back about Dr. Phil Novus's bid that was successful through the MB, I think it was the Endeavour Fund, and that work is really targeted at developing our sensor, so that's something that we're supporting Dr. Novus's team on.
Excellent, thank you. Councillor Deacon.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, thank you. This report's interesting and it's what we expected to hear from Dr. Olsen. I noticed at the end he talks about the project with Landcare Research running through for 3 years, and that seems a hell of a long time out for a problem which is clearly, at least seasonally, getting worse. Do we have any indication at all from the expert group that Dr. Olsen can report on about when we're going to have sufficient information to know what it is we're dealing with and what we might be able to do about it? When is the likely date for that to happen?
Dr. Olsen.
That's a very difficult question to answer through you, Mr. Chairman. It's at this stage, I guess the statement I just made around developing the technology just to be able to quantify lake snow illustrates where we're starting from. This is an emerging issue internationally, and there really isn't anything. We can't draw on other people's experiences of this, so it's going to be a long-term challenge for us. I think that I'd be lying if I said anything other than that. At this stage, we're working on understanding the nature of the problem and being able to measure it as an important part of that, and then from there we can start to look at, you know, what the drivers are. Now, that was the approach that the expert group convened just over a year ago, and, you know, suggested by them. So I acknowledge the frustration, but this is going to be a long-term challenge for us.
Thank you. Any other queries, questions? Councillor Laws.
Well, I don't think that's an answer. Saying we don't, is the answer we don't know to Councillor Deacon's question?
We don't know what, sorry?
Well, he asked you for a time reference or a time frame.
Yes, no, we
when
don't know.
You would possibly, you don't know.
That's right.
Yes, that's a lot of reassurance to the community, isn't it?
Councillors, I think in fairness, Dr. Olsen, I mean, the question was a challenging question, and Dr. Olsen made that clear at the front end, and we are essentially, what I can understand, breaking new ground here to try and understand the challenge.
What do you do?
No.
But the question was asked.
No, sorry. Councillor Laws, in fairness, this is not something that we have had the experience, expertise, or any other regional council within New Zealand has been able to provide us a pathway to follow, so to speak. So we are breaking new ground. I think you need to accept that.
Yes, I don't think that's relevant. The issue here is you're into your quantify-qualify status, Dr. Olsen, and then the next stage is working out what you call the drivers or the cause of the particular problem. And then we move into the remedies phase. To clarify, when do you expect to have some sort of date structure around causes? When will you know that?
I certainly think the initial work around the drivers, so you know, that's things like nutrients, nutrient loadings to the lakes, and sensitivity to of lake snow to that. There's the potential that it's a climate change effect. I mean, those are the sorts of things I mean by drivers. I would expect us to be starting to investigate those in next financial year. That would be based on delivering this work and then moving on to the next priority areas.
So are you saying that by the end of the 2018-19 financial year, you should know what the drivers are?
No, I'm saying that is when we will be starting that work, and I mean we don't know what we don't know at this stage. So there will be initial indications at the end of next financial year, and then it may require further work. I mean, that's the nature of science. If we knew the answer, then we wouldn't need to do the work.
Cool. Before I go to Councillor Deacon, I'll go to Dr. Palmer first and then to the Chief Executive, because it just may help to create a pathway forward.
Through you, Mr. Chairman. So in Appendix A of my report, we've set out some timeframes for a research program. And I think the question is around, coming from the other end, when will we get to sort of decision points, milestones as an outcome of the research? So I think what we'll do is we'll bring back to committee those answers. When do we expect to know whether it's solvable or whatever? The other thing that might be timely to do is to just go back to the experts and see if there's anything about this program that could be accelerated, you know, in terms of funding or whatever, just to check that the time frame is still the best possible time frame a year on from asking those same experts. So I can bring that back to the committee if that's helpful.
That'd be great.
Excellent. I'm not sure that maybe the Chief Executive, that what you're going to suggest has been covered now, but...
Absolutely. No, I would absolutely agree with that. I think it's important that we bring back to Council something that has some milestone timeframes in it, so you can understand how we're going to map the work out. And, of course, findings at different stages will be important for determining next steps, I would imagine. So we'll do that.
Thank you.
Yep. Mr. Chairman,
before we go to Councillor Dick, sorry. Councillor Woodhead, is it going to...
Councillor Lawrence just text me to please speak directly and firmly into your microphones. You might need to pull your microphones a bit closer.
Sure. Thank you. Councillor Deacon.
I'm just going to ask, can you turn the microphone in the phone unit itself? Because I've used the boardroom table. You have to speak loudly in the room for her to hear.
Right. Speak up. All I was going to say, Mr. Chairman, was that's been a very useful discussion. I thank everybody who's been involved in it. But the thing that's missing is the stakeholder bit. What this tells me is that our engagement with all the people who have got a stake in those lakes has got to be regular, informative, solid, so that everybody knows each stage of this long process where we're at, what we're achieving, if anything, who we're working with, what their role is to play in this, whether it be run holders around the lakes or whether it be the district councils involved with the lakes. And I do hope that Drs. Palmer and Olson have really got their stakeholder engagement hats on right through this process, so that everybody in Otago, because we've all got stakes in those beautiful lakes, everybody knows what we're doing, when we're doing it, who we're doing it with, and how it's going. That's got to be a very regular event, in my opinion. I hope everybody agrees.
Well said. Thank you. Any further discussion on that item? Okay. Moving on to item four, the lake trophic status. It has some good news. Dr. Olson.
Yes, so the lake trophic monitoring in the Alpine Lakes has been ongoing for just over a year now, so we thought that it was timely to provide an update out of that, the first year of monitoring. Previous monitoring, it was done in 2006-2007, there were some limitations at that stage around laboratory detection limits and that sort of thing, which potentially affected how much we could say about the state of those lakes, and we've addressed those as far as we can with the current monitoring. So we're using the lowest detection limits that we can. these lakes pose a real challenge in that the water is so clean that the sort of levels that we're routinely getting are challenging the best that the laboratories can provide. So the results really confirm that the three large lakes are in microtrophic state, so that's essentially the cleanest state that you see in the natural environment, that Lake Onslow is in a mesotrophic state and Lake Hayes being eutrophic. So it was really just an update for councillors to see what the results of that first year of monitoring have been, and then to put it in some context by plotting the trophic lake index, so the TLI, that is a means of comparing the trophic status of different lakes, comparing our lakes, Lakes Wanaka, Hawea and Wakatipu, to the rest of New Zealand based on the national data set, and it shows that these three lakes have the lowest TLI in the country.
Thank you. Councillor Laws.
Can I ask the question about why Lake Dunstan isn't there? If the answer is because it's not natural, then I've noted that in the recent survey on lakes, Aviemore, Ohau and Benmore were included in that, which are also man-made lakes from hydroelectric schemes. So why isn't Lake Dunstan being similarly monitored?
So Lake Dunstan is a has quite a short residence time. Just to give you, and I'm just pulling these figures from my memory, Lake Wanaka, Hawea and Wakatipu, they have residence times in the order of years. So if I remember right, Wanaka's about, on average, a molecule of water sits in Lake Wanaka for about 6 years before going out the outlet. In the case of Lake Dunstan, because it's a long, narrow lake with a huge amount of water that comes in from the top being released naturally from Lake Wanaka, but also from the Hawea control structure, residence time is in the order of days.
But isn't that true of Aviemore and Benmore too?
Yeah, they are large lakes, and they're certainly. I'd have to look into the residence times for those. But the reason for focusing on residence time is it's a really good predictor of susceptibility to nutrient inputs.
Does that mean you're doing no sampling of Lake Dunstan at all?
There is monitoring of Lake Dunstan currently.
Well,
but
then
it's shore based.
Sorry, was then why didn't you detect the E. coli, for example, on Lake Dunstan last week?
So the Lake Dunstan monitoring is done at a single point, close to the main bridge there, over into Cromwell itself. So it's not going to detect E. coli that is localised. So you can get E. coli from riverine sources.
Yeah.
If you have a septic tank that's leaking on a shore, it can cause localised increases in E. coli. So we're not going to detect that at a site several kilometres away.
So does that mean that if Lake Snow goes into Lake Dunstan, you won't know?
Lake Snow is presently in Lake Dunstan.
Okay, so you're not doing any monitoring of Lake Dunstan?
Not specifically for Lake Snow.
I do want to flag that as a policy issue, because I think it's really important for us to survey Lake Dunstan, no matter how long the water spends there. And when I looked at other regional councils with hydro dams, lakes, I noticed that they were monitoring them, and that they are included in the national study that's just recently been released. So it seems to me to be a significant gap in our environmental monitoring of the southern lakes, from excluding Lake Dunstan from that process.
So are you of a mind to move something that we're asking to be considered by the policy?
Lake Dunstan added to the lake monitoring process of the Otago Regional Council.
So if you just want to pause for a moment to see whether Lauren has got the wording correctly, but what I was just going to ask, this would go to, it would be a report that would come to the policy committee, would that be correct? Or question for Dr. Palmer.
Well, can I perhaps form another motion? Can I form another motion
and
say that we get a paper that comes to our next committee round on the monitoring, or adding the monitoring of Lake Dunstan to our environmental lakes program.
Okay.
And then we can have all facts and then make our decision appropriate.
I'll second that, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Councillors. Councillor Deacon. What I'm going to do firstly is just ask for some guidance from Dr. Palmer, and then I'll go to Lauren just to ask her to read the wording of the motion so we all understand what we're requesting. Dr. Palmer, any issues, concerns with what's being requested?
I think we're being asked for a paper around purpose, value and cost. Just to be clear, because we have talked about TLI and Lake Snow, and those are quite different things, so can we get a bit more specificity around the particular issue to be monitored would be helpful for staff, because they are slightly chalk and cheese.
Well, words were added into the resolution, purpose, value and cost, would that be useful?
Well, can I say that I'd like to duplicate or be able to see that the same kind of monitoring that happens in the other lakes happens off Lake Dunstan.
Okay.
That's clear.
Well,
I think it's purpose, value and cost of comparable monitoring in Lake Dunstan compared to the other, or to the three alpine lakes, if I understand that.
Yes, but it'd be useful to know for us exactly the monitoring that occurs in those other lakes and how that could be translated.
Okay. So, just when you're ready, Lauren. Comfortable with that, Councillor Laws?
Yes, that's fine.
Comfortable, Councillor Deacon?
Yep, that's very good.
I'm more as guaranteed that Councillor Lawton hasn't heard this, and, and if we had a mobile microphone, I would hand it over to you. But you're just going to have to trust us here, Councillor Lawton. Well, you may want to abstain.
Is this actually in the best position?
Should it be there?
I'm wondering, actually, it should be placed there.
Yeah.
We can deal with that. Well, let's deal with this motion. Oh, sorry. Councillor Robinson, sorry.
In framing up the motion at the moment, it is quite broad in terms of trophic lake status. And we have got trophic lake status monitoring in more than just the inland lakes, from what I'm aware of. So there's actually other lakes across Otago, and we would need to look at trophic lake monitoring and the benefits and costs right across Otago, so what are the best sites and what are we gathering the information for? So if we were doing it, we'd need to put it in context of all the sites that we're doing and just how much it costs and what added value we would get with adding Lake Dunstan. So I think it would be quite a bigger paper than just inland lakes.
Okay. So the question around the current wording...
It's broad enough moment to include that,
okay.
I think. Yeah.
Thank you.
Yep.
Councillor Woody, then Councillor Scott.
Thank you, Mr Chairman. Firstly, I'm pretty sure we've had this discussion in the last 12 months already, and we've had it very clearly articulated, the difference between the lakes and the basis for the monitoring that's currently in place. Secondly, and it's in this agenda, we've spent quite a lot of money and had our State of the Environment Monitoring Program reviewed independently by experts. We're not scientists, so I think we need to take that into account too, and I'm looking forward to hearing from Dr. Palmer, and there's some choices there. And so Lake Dunstan is monitored with appropriate monitoring on relying on our science staff for the type of lake it is. And there's other monitoring. In this case, we're talking about TLI, and I'd have to say, while we're on the topic, very pleasing to see it's all improved a little bit across the whole lot. And I've got a follow-up question on that, the broader topic, once we've dealt with this motion. So I think we just need to keep those other things in mind. There's a lot of detail in the report back from NIWA, Dr. Palmer, that reviewed our State of the Environment Monitoring Program to ensure it's fit for purpose. And Dr. Palmer's given us later in the paper some of options, and we can make that decision then. So I struggle with the need. I don't support this motion because the work's been done elsewhere and these conversations have already been had.
Thank you. Councillor Scott.
Yeah, a couple of things just following on from Councillor Woodhead. State of the Environment, correct me if I'm wrong, there are two doctors, Lake Snow isn't necessary, you know, our investigations on the trophic nature of these lakes isn't necessarily state of the environment. So we may have had a comprehensive review, but it doesn't mean that on a particular issue we have to look independently. Say, for example, with water quality in our rivers, we have the state of the environment. Then maybe to implement our water plan, we need to have... So it's not necessarily the same. Now, Councillor Laws referred to Lake Dunstan. The area that was actually in my mind was Lake Tomahawk Lagoon. So Councillor Robinson's talked about the other lakes within the region, but I assume it's other lagoons and so forth as well. So it's certainly opening a can of worms. I suspect at the end of the day it comes down to consistency and priority. But or maybe my question is to Dr. Palmer, has this question actually been answered before?
Mr. Chairman, I think the item in discussion is basically an item around state, the tropic status in the lakes, and I wonder whether or not this discussion about program design, redesign, expansion might better be handled later in our agenda when we've got a paper on that very subject.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman.
So the motion, would you prefer to deal with the motion? I know the discussion is going to spill out into a number of wider topics. Would it be wise to park the motion and deal with it then?
I think so. There might be some other issues emerge.
Okay. So from the move...
Can I make a comment in terms of I would like to postpone the agreement and have the answer to the question of how the status of the lakes in terms of the trophic status relates to the state of the environment reporting, because I think that's an important relationship.
Did you want to comment on that? No, okay. To the mover and the seconder, are you comfortable that we deal with this motion when we deal with the state of the environment?
As long as we deal with it.
Okay. Everyone comfortable with that,
yeah,
that approach?
I'm comfortable. I'm not comfortable with the attempts around the table to kind of kill this motion by putting it into a regional context. This motion is specifically about one lake, which is a very significant lake to the people of Otago, from Alexandra to north of Bendigo. This is a highly used, highly looked at, highly crossed, highly lived by lake. And I agree with Councillor Laws, I don't think we know enough about it.
Okay.
I'm not talking about any other lakes in the region, just this one.
Point taken, and we'll have a further discussion once we deal with the state of environment monitoring later on in the meeting. Okay.
Mr. Chairman, can I just very quickly on the tropical lake status? So they've all improved, and this is the first year's data of a three-year testing regime. How much certainty can we take from the first year's data?
Dr. Olson.
Yeah, I don't know that we can go on to say that there has been an improvement, because the previous data was subject to the limitations of the methods at the time. So the reduction in TLI likely reflects the fact that we're actually using those low detection tests. I think a year's worth of data it certainly gives you a snapshot for that 1 year. Previously, the trophic lake monitoring in these big lakes was done 3 years in every 10. So I think if this same sort of pattern continues for another 2 years, then I think we can start to speak about it with some certainty. But certainly, 1 year is giving us a snapshot of what it was like last year. and that snapshot is positive. As we gather more data, we'll be able to say that with more certainty. Thank you.
Thank you. Moving on to the next item, Lake Hayes remediation options. Dr. Olson, any comments?
Not particularly, Mr. Chair. This item was is a target for this year's annual plan. We've currently got NIWA assessing potential intervention options that came out of discussions with the Friends of Lake Hayes and a report that Dr. Schellenberg had prepared. NIWA are currently working on essentially what that means in terms of logistics, you know, the practical details of how you'd actually do it. That work's then going to feed into some modelling work that the University of Waikato is going to do for us, looking at the likely effectiveness of those different methods, and then that will feed into a cost benefit analysis done of the various options.
Thank you. Queries, comments, Councillor Robertson.
I wanted to comment on this one. Good to see this work happening. Obviously, there's been a lot of impetus for this to occur over many, many years. But I'm going to speak up again about wider context and prioritisation across our region as we go forward. It is a requirement under the NES freshwater to improve degraded waterways, definitely. Rivers, whether they be deep, shallow, brackish, rivers as well, and estuaries, so whichever waterways they may be. So I think as a region we do need to be a bit cleverer at prioritising, at classifying, and at having some sort of planned program for how we're going to do that. I know we have plan changes for various aspects of waterway improvement, but which ones do we spend a lot of money on intervention? Which ones don't we? What is the type of program we're looking at? Is it a really active intervention? Is it a long-term gradual improvement? I think we don't want to be leaping into projects without having a wider context. Do see, though, that this will be of benefit, this work. We will understand whether or not we can implement one of these methods, the three of them listed there, and how much that would cost, and that's going to be really useful for the community. What I'm saying is we need to be planning and thinking about how we're going to meet our requirements under the NES freshwater a bit more strategically. Thanks.
Well said.
Thank you. Any further discussion?
Yeah.
Councillor Lawton?
Robertson on her point, and also the additional work being carried out about the economic impacts of remediation in the sector, I think will be helpful for that discussion and business case creation. Can I also ask on what the timeframes are for this work, please?
Dr. Olson, I think that's a question for you.
Yes, so we're just working through that at the moment. We're looking to have bring something back to council at the end of the financial year, I think was the original plan. We're just currently talking with the Waikato people as to timing of when they can actually do their work. As you can imagine, that a lot of this work is sort of sequential, so if we get a delay in one part, then it'll flow on to others, but certainly early in the new financial year.
And any comment with regards to Councillor Robertson's point about meeting any national environmental freshwater standards?
Yeah, certainly that is a consideration for us, and this work will really help inform the discussion around that prioritisation of where to undertake those interventions to address any water bodies that don't meet the national bottom lines.
Okay. Thank you.
A follow-on question from them is in terms of the annual long-term plan, what kind of, are we putting a placeholder in for the funding of any possible outcomes from this work, or how are we dealing with that if we're not going to have the information for some time?
Question for Dr. Olson? Dr. Palmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Because of the uncertainty about which option might be preferred, what it would cost, and how it might be paid for, and when it would be undertaken, there was insufficient certainty around all of those things to put it in as any sort of meaningful placeholder in our long-term plan, so for the moment it doesn't feature. Mr. Donnelly might correct me if I've got that wrong, but I think that's where we landed in terms of provision for anything that might arise from this current annual plan activity.
Mr. Donnelly?
Respect to Lake Hayes and in works in future years. No provision because...
Yeah, can we then communicate that as soon as possible to the likes of the Friends of Lake Hayes, because we will certainly be hearing from them if they don't see it in our plan, and give some sort of timeline to them about what will be required so that they can an answer from council as to what we might be doing in response to that research, because we will hear from them.
Mr. Donnelly, did you want to confirm or not that...
So the question was, what have we got in the LTP around Lake Hayes remediation?
Correct.
Yeah.
And then it was a request that we
communicate
in communication with Lake Hayes about where we're at with this project, rather than waiting for them to find out through the long-term plan process.
Yeah. My understanding
is... I can answer the second question. Improved engagement with Friends of Lake Hayes is something that Ms. Sutton is dealing with, and so we'll ensure that that second matter is attended to.
Can I just clarify, though, Andrew,
with
Nick, although we're not putting a cost estimate into the long-term plan, I assume that we are putting it in as a future potential work stream into the long-term plan, are we? Because if we are to leave it out entirely, that would send entirely the wrong signal.
Okay, so through the chair, without having the LTP, what we were proposing in front of me, we were putting in the provision initially for doing investigation work. Dr. Palmer's nodding, that'd be right, but we haven't put in anything that any cost provision for anything that might come out of that subsequent to that, because obviously it's all what we might do or how it might be funded or the actual cost will have to fall out of that. So it would be one of those things that we've indicated initially that we will be investigating and looking at what options are, and then it would, anything that might come out of that would be consulted by subsequent annual plans as amendments to the LTP.
Right,
but we haven't put in anything because that would be essentially predetermining what costs might be or where it would be funded, and we just don't know the answer to those things.
I'm just trying to ensure that in the text that goes alongside that line item in the long-term plan, just what you've said is what's going to be communicated in the long-term plan. Because I'd hate to see investigation of Lake Hayes, and that would send them feeling that, yes, they're going to investigate it, but they're not actually going to do anything about it when we've found out what it is. I think we need to clarify that. We need to find out what it is first and have that in the text of the long-term plan.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think in fairness on that topic, when you read the update, we're clearly moving in modelling, cost-benefit analysis, etc. in this work. Staff have engaged NIWA to do that work, so we're obviously committed to determining a particular option. That's the way I read that. But I understand what you're saying, Councillor Laws.
Just making sure that we've got the words in that says that.
Yeah, and obviously the LTP's been drafted, and on that particular one, I can't remember what wording we put, but based on what you've said, we can look at how we word that.
Thank you.
Councillor Kempton.
Yeah, I think we've very nearly got to where I think we ought to be. The communication exercise to me is double-barrel. One of them is talking about where we've got to with this proposition, where we might go. But the second one is making sure that the Friends of Lake Hayes absolutely understand the long-term plan and the annual plan process and the ability to vary a long-term plan through public consultation and so on, so that it sits off to one side. When we've got a deal that we think we should put to the public, then the option is to do that. So I think there are two things here, is how the planning works and where we've got to.
Very good. And I imagine historically we've had a staff member attend Friends of Lake Hayes meetings, whether it's an AGM or a general meeting, to help bring them up to speed. Ms Sutton, are you able to...
So I've made a commitment to meet with Friends of Lake Hayes quarterly. Just before Christmas, I did attend one of their committee meetings. And myself and one of the officers are currently in conversations with Friends of Lake Hayes to organise a meeting coming up within the next few weeks. So leading up to this committee, we've been very transparent about what's being presented today. And we've been very, very clear about the options that we're pursuing. And I'm confident that we're on the same page in terms of understanding what's happening next. And I will definitely add the LTP to the agenda for that meeting that's coming up.
Excellent, thank you. All set. Moving on to the next item, which is the Clutha River Bioenergetics. What's the modelling that's been done on the Clutha? Dr. Olson, comments?
This is an update for councillors. It's been a project that's been ongoing for some time. Councillors may remember we had some delays with unsuitable flows, too high flows in those particular years. We're now moving towards the delivery phase, or well into the delivery phase of that work, and anticipating bringing a paper to a committee in the near future presenting the Cawthron work. And then subsequent to that, there will be a management flow report for the Clutha, the whole Clutha catchment. It will come to a subsequent committee meeting.
And that obviously helps to guide the whole minimum flow discussion that we're having with the community. Queries, questions? Everyone comfortable? Okay. Moving on. Item 7, Hawea Aquifers Monitoring. Once again, Dr. Olson, sorry to be persistent, but any comment?
No, again, it's really just an update for councillors. There's been some public interest in the Hawea Basin aquifer, and there is a project in the current annual plan that my team and I are undertaking to develop a transient model. Previous modelling for this particular aquifer has been done as a steady state model, and there are technical shortcomings of taking a steady state modelling approach, and a transient is the sort of the next stage of development in terms of sophistication of the model. So that's currently underway, and the item really is just summarising where we're up to with that.
Okay, thank you. Queries, questions? Councillor Hope.
Through the Chair. Dr. Olson, can you just elaborate a little bit more on the transient? Do you mean how could you explain it?
Okay, so a steady state model doesn't have time as part of the model. So it essentially getting slightly out of my field of expertise, but a transient model includes time in that. So it looks at how inflows into the aquifer change through time and how things like pumping affect water levels in the aquifer through time. So pumping, obviously, people aren't pumping necessarily all the time, and they may pump at different rates at different times. So the transient model allows us to take that into account and consider how that affects the water levels in the aquifer through time, whereas a steady state essentially says you set the water level, you set the inputs into the model, and then you just run an assumed abstraction rate, and that's obviously quite a simplistic way of approaching it, but it expands the sophistication of models the more time and more expense there is associated with it. So.
Thank you.
Excellent. Any other queries, comments? If not, moving on, you may have a spell now, I think, Dr. Olson, a brief one. So item 8, July 2017 coastal Otago flood event.
welcome to Dr. Jean Luke Payan, who is the Manager of Natural Hazards. Welcome, Dr. Payan. Any comments?
No, that's really an update on the work we're doing after the July flood event. So for the moment, we've captured a lot of cross-sectional information on bank and riverbed for the Tari and Silver Stream, and we are in the process of analyzing that, see what kind of erosion we had, mainly in the flood protection scheme area, because that got consequences on how the scheme operates and the level of protection. And the other update is on a flood hazard study that we started before the July event, but the July event gave us the opportunity to do a lot of measurements to refine the study, and that's around the Ophiro stream south of Mosgiel. And the intention there is to understand the flood hazard and the interaction between stormwater and the drainage network that the ORC is managing.
Excellent, thank you. Comments, questions? If not, everyone comfortable? Moving on to item 9, Henley flooding. Payan, once again, it's reasonably self-explanatory, but any comment?
No, no specific comment.
Councillor Hope.
Thank you, through the Chair. Dr. Palmer, I'm delighted that you went out to meet them. Thank you very much for doing that. I know Councillor Noonan, I really appreciate that. Just going to ask you another question. Are you aware of DCC, do you know? Have they done their bits of maintenance and cleaned out the ditches and all those culverts? Are you aware of any work being done by them so far?
Through you, Mr. Chairman, I don't have the details of where they've got to with their maintenance, but on this initiative we are working closely with DCC collaboratively on the matters that are set out in our report here, but I can follow up on that and just check the status of that work that they were intending to undertake.
Thank you. Councillor Kempton.
Yes, just with respect to Henley, is there any work proceeding currently to look at what the ramifications might be of relocating the township as opposed to work that might be done up ahead? Are we anywhere near the point where that might become relevant?
Through you, Mr. Chairman, we have no work planned at the moment for a more strategic view of Henley. But the time has probably come for that, given the repeat floods and what we know about climate change and other things.
If I might just add a rider to that, you would expect DCC to lead that, but us in our normal role of providing technical support. Any discussion of that kind?
It would certainly need to be done collaboratively. Mm. It is somewhat connected to the rest of the Lower Tyree Flood Protection Scheme, so therefore we might on this occasion be more involved in options in terms of some leadership around that. But yes, certainly a collaborative effort.
Thank you for that.
I think it's also important to remember that as the owner of significant assets, and as Dr. Palmer's alluded to in the comments, is that it's important to ensure that those assets are fit for purpose. And I appreciate Councillor Kempton's comments. Discussion about the long term is a separate kettle of fish. Excuse my language. Okay, anything else in that regard regarding Henley? If not, moving on to New Zealand, item 10, New Zealand CRI's program, which is Dr. Payan.
Dr. Payan's team is heavily involved in that. We'll just take any questions, Mr.
Okay.
Chairman.
Any queries? Councillor Scott.
The question's slightly to the side, but last year we were expecting at some point a study on international options and best practice for situations where there was flooding or sea level rise issues. So the question's slightly to the side, but where are we at with that report? It just seems to have gone quiet.
Through Mr. Chairman, we've been working with Dunedin City Council as the co-sponsor of what to do next in terms of, is there anything coming out of that that we might wish to investigate further, and how will we go about reporting it to our respective councils? So I will come back to you on that.
Because, I mean, just following up from that, I assumed it was a relatively independent report. It didn't need massaging or even a look at by the DCC. It was an independent analysis of best practice in difficult situations. So if I misinterpreted that, does it need massaging?
Through Mr. Chairman, you're correct, it's a piece of independent work, but to be helpful for council, we then need to say, well, what do you do with it? What do we take from this, and how is it relevant to the particular situation we have? And that's the piece we're still working on together.
Okay.
Thank you.
We won't be changing the report. It's a piece of independent comment.
Thank you. Moving on to item 11, collaborating with territorial authorities on district plan and natural hazards. Once again, this is work that's been going on for some time with Dunedin City, now working with Waitaki District as they work through their review of their district plan. Any comments, questions? Just an update, really. Happy enough. Moving on. Item 12, Mount Alpha Wanaka Fire. Dr. Palmer. Dr. Payne.
Dr. Mackey.
Sorry.
I might just briefly speak to this, if I may, and introduce Dr. Ben Mackey, Natural Hazards Analyst, and Dr. Payne's team, who has been involved in this matter. He has prior experience in California dealing with bushfire effects on similar situations. So Dr. Mackey has undertaken an initial site assessment. And reported back in a moment he will explain what he found. But one of the findings is that the existing flow paths through land downstream of the hill are quite important to managing the risk. So at the moment we're mapping those flow paths and then have a piece of work underway to check that there are no impediments to flow through them given the build-up environment there. As you know, there is some heavy rain forecast for parts of Otago for tonight. And so as a precautionary measure, we're doing some work around informing potentially affected landholders in the area, just as a precautionary measure, let them know about the situation and what we're doing about it, and what they might like to do about it as well. So Ms. Sutton has that underway at the moment, and we have civil defence hooked into that as well.
Welcome, Mr. Mackey. Welcome aboard to the organisation.
Thank you.
Good to have you here. So we're in your hands.
Speak up.
Yep. I went up with one of the operations staff on Monday and drove around the burnt area. Basically, the severity of the fire was quite high, such that pretty much all tussock and grass has been incinerated over a large area of the fire, which leaves ash and sort of loose soil just lying on the slopes there. The concern with that, mixed with potentially quite intense rainfall, is the potential for the debris and ash to mobilise and flow down the gullies so it's very concentrated mud flows. The problem with that is once they get to the bottom of the hill, which has got large-scale residential dwellings along that portion, is what happens to these flows once they get there. So given the field conditions and the forecasts, there is a reasonable chance that we could be seeing mud flows coming off that slope.
Thank you for that. Any questions, comments?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, that's
Councillor Baker.
Pretty scary stuff when you think of Meadowstone and how Stony Creek literally goes through people's front yard, right through that big suburb. And I wonder what Ms. Sutton's got in mind for letting those people know at a suburban level about the possibilities of what could happen tonight and tomorrow.
I'll go to Dr. Palmer then, Ms. Sutton.
Through Mr. Chairman, maybe before Ms. Sutton answers that question, Dr. Mackey might like to clarify geographically which parts of Stony Creek, which parts of Waterfall Creek, and then, as I understand it, it's mostly the face between those two creeks, but he might like to just clarify that, because it's relevant to whom do we talk with.
Yes, that's correct.
Can I please request that Mr. Mackey talking to the microphone that gave him that, because I can't hear him at all when it's...
Another end of the room.
I think it's going to be there, isn't it?
Yeah.
Just have to speak up or come up.
Mm-hmm. We'll move that down. It's distorted and it's broken when it's
Come up here then. Thank you.
Righto.
Thank you.
Is this better?
Lovely, thank you.
Okay. Yeah, that Dr. Palmer was correct in that the burnt area was fortunately not largely within the catchments of Stony Creek or Waterfall Creek, which are known potentially debris flow producing catchments. The burnt area was on a largely planar slope between these two drainage basins, and there is a very poorly developed channel network across the burnt area, such that any potential flows are likely to be comparatively small and not concentrate down one channel. There was partial burning in the lower portions of Stony Creek, but it's a very small amount compared to the rest of the fire.
So can I clarify, is there any risk or danger to existing residences from this?
Yes, I would.
Okay, so we need to be informing those residences. Can you quantify how many residences are at risk?
We've got a communication plan going out this afternoon where people downslope of the slope in potential flow paths are being notified. There's an estimate of number of dwellings, possibly the 30 to 50 range.
Ms. Sutton,
Chair,
did you...
Just to answer Councillor Deaker and Councillor Laws...
Close.
Okay. Questions. We're currently collaborating with QLDC. There are 30 to 50 residents that will be directly affected. A letter has been drafted and is going out this morning as soon as Dr. Palmer reviews it. And so they're directly being notified. We're also going to do some media activity, so the Mayor at QLDC has been involved as well. We're trying to strike the balance, I guess, between not being alarmist but also ensuring those residents are informed. If it does get into an emergency situation, civil defence are completely briefed and they'll be also on site. And at this point, Gavin, Dr. Palmer will be the spokesperson on the issue if we are contacted by media. But we're trying to front foot this, but not be alarmist.
Lovely. Thank you, Dr. Palmer.
Mr. Chairman, I'll just add to Ms. Sutton's comments and Dr. Mackey's comments about vulnerability. In any one event, to which degree any of those 30 to 50 are affected will be very event specific. So we're not saying that if something happens, we automatically have all 30 to 50 properties being impacted. It'll be some subset of those. So we're being very precautionary in terms of an envelope of possible effects, and then we can hopefully narrow that down through the further technical work we have undertaken.
Through the Chair, one more comment. Happy to circulate that media alert once it goes out to councillors if you would like. And I have been liaising with Councillor Lawton, so she's aware of the strategy.
That would be appreciated if you're able to circulate that media release. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. McKay. So moving on to geomorphic change detection. Dr. Palmer, thank you.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, that's just for noting, and that's an initiative that Dr. Mackey is also involved in as well, so you'll be familiar. We've reported to you before, just a reminder, it's continuing.
Good. Okay. Everyone comfortable?
Yep.
Item 11, item 14, Lower Waitaki River Scheme. Councillor Brown and Dr. Palmer attended the liaison group meeting. Dr. Palmer or Councillor Brown, was there any comments you wanted to make?
I'll just assume, Mr. Chairman, I just think staff have been working to a more effective collaboration with Environment Canterbury on this matter. So we've done some things like getting together earlier in the planning cycle to agree on the technical program, and then hopefully the liaison group meeting has been held earlier in the planning cycle as well. So from a staff perspective, the process has been improved and is working well.
I think from a governance point of view, cross-boundary issues being dealt in this manner is refreshing, knowing that we're both on the same page. But you're comfortable, Councillor Brown?
Yep.
Questions, queries? If not, moving on. The Clutha River offsetting, which is belongs to who?
I can speak to that, Mr. Chairman. So Clutha River offsetting is just to bring to your attention a matter that we are looking into, and hopefully we will be able to take you to that location as part of the council meeting in that locality next month. We just a bit of background.
Yeah. And that's sort of been a challenging area for many a year.
Yes, it is. This is technically very complex, and from a financial point of view, potentially quite significant as well. It's very early days yet, but it's really just a flag. We've got a risk there, and we are onto it in terms of an assessment, and as soon as we have further information, we will report to you.
Okay, thank you. Queries, questions? Comfortable? Okay, moving on to item 16, Central Targa Stock Truck Effluent Disposal Site.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman,
through
you.
Oh, sorry, we have got, Councillor Bell. Mr. Valentine, sorry, Manager Engineering. Sorry, Councillor Bell.
Yep, through you, Mr. Chairman. I'd just like to say that even though it maybe looked like a very convenient site on State Highway 6 for the effluent disposal site to be located, it is the opinion of the Central Target District Council, and I support that. And then I also note in today's paper that Councillor Moores also supports that opinion. It is undesirable because it will be opposite what is proposed to be a new subdivision in the near future. And a lot of that development is taking place along there. Also, I would like to point out that it's my understanding from the CODC roading manager, Murray Hassler, and he contacted me actually on my way down to the last combined transport meeting between Targa and Southam, where this was to be on the agenda. And he explained to me that they were having difficulties with the engineering staff at ORC at that time with communication, as in knowing, getting feedback with regards to the site. I don't know whether that has been cleared up. I did ask at our combined meeting for us to be fully informed on the progress of that, yet I have had no information in front of me, and I'm not sure whether my colleague, the chairman of the joint committee, Councillor Kempton, received anything with regards to that or not. But through you, Mr. Chairman, I think that there needs to be alternative sites to be looked at, and I don't know whether there is and what, because actually I haven't actually seen a proper report on it at all as a member of this council, let alone a member of the combined Regional Plans Transport Committee. There's nothing in here that actually even shows me where the sites are, as in a map or that for any of the other members to be able to understand the proposed choice that is being promoted, and that may have helped in the debate here today. I also would like to add that in my previous experience of attending these meetings of the Joint Committee, it has been discussed, and Councillor Kempton may wish to support this, that one of the ex-chairman, Commissioner Rex Williams of Environment Canterbury, had made a strong recommendation that the joint committees look at getting private enterprise, roading transport, to take these effluent disposal stations over. And as we all know, under the law at the moment, that isn't able to be actioned. There's two reasons for that, and I'm going to bore you, you've probably heard me before. One is the transport department, or the police, cannot police it, any effluent being disposed on the road, because the Act doesn't cover it. Well, they haven't got an Act to cover it, I should say. And the other thing is that we need to get government to make policy to be able to put that onus back onto private transport to be able to fund these through the way of paying for the disposal of effluent. To do that, and we've raised it here at the table before, there's been a letter, my understanding, sent from this council, from the Combined Regional Transport Council Committee to this council and to the Southland, Environment Southland, and they have asked for the support of the chairs to promote local government to get a remit to go forward to be able to change this outlook. So getting back to, I've just got a wee bit away from where I was probably should be, but getting back to that State Highway 61 in Clonmel, I believe that, and I don't know whether it has been approach made to large local transport operator, who happens to be just only 100 metres, would that be right, Councillor Laws, just off the main highway there, and whether he would be prepared to locate a site on his property. It's already being done. The one in Waitaki, for argument's sake, is done in the Fury Freezing Works. So we have already these sites located off State Highway. That is the only one I know, apart from the other areas, as in Southland, where there is individual roading transport operators that are also providing effluent disposal sites. And that was the argument that Rex Williams had, the from Environment Canterbury, who happens to be also the chair of the Richardson Transport Group. So we need to be pushing for that. And we also sent a letter while I'm on this with regards to this committee, to this council, with regards to the rating. Now, the Otago Southland Joint Committee has sent a letter in suggesting, do the same as what Southland is, that the rating for the disposal of the effluent, rather than being the responsibility of individual district councils, that it be put right across the district, as will Southland. And I would like that to be looked at seriously by the council. So getting back to Central Otago District Council, they could be up for a maximum of five effluent sites. That has been talked around the combined regional transport committees, which is the existing one at Race Junction, the one that's been proposed at Highway 6 at Cromwell, coming up towards Highlands Park there. The reason for that is to avoid any effluent being dropped in through the Kawara and perhaps down to the next station, which happens to be at Five Rivers, which is below Kingston. So the other one is the second option, which you'll note that CODC have suggested that they are agreeable to, is the one on Springvale, which is near near Cadell's Farm. I've just forgotten the name of the road, better. And the other proposed ones in the future could well be in Kyburn and Terrace, and that would bring us up to five disposal sites. And so we need to be looking how that is going to be financed. But to be honest, I believe it is the responsibility, not the responsibility of the ratepayer or the taxpayer, it is the responsibility of the users. And we have to get to a stage where we have a Zap Go card that the operators can and pay for it, or they, on their own initiatives, provide their own dumping space. So, Mr. Chairman, there is some issues there, and I just want to have the opportunity of highlighting that, and I believe that this council has to take a little bit more serious approach towards it. Thank you.
Thank you. Before I go to Councillor Kempton, I'll go to Mr. Valentine. I just wonder whether you could just cover off where the communication is between the two entities as we're trying to resolve the concern about this particular site. If you could cover off the investigation that's been done to identify the site, and also any investigation of other alternative sites to the State Highway 6 site that we're discussing in this report. Are you just able to paint a bit of a picture on those three aspects, please?
Yes, certainly. So in regard to your first question...
You may have to speak up a little bit, Mr. You may actually have to come down here. There may be a good idea.
I'll just come down here.
Yep. Yep.
Much mucking around. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In regard to your first question in relating to communications, I would just say that we started communications with CODC in March 2017, and that communication was to Mr. Hazard. Hazard delegated that communication to their engineers and their three waters team, and communications continued in March, and then in June when we received more details on potential sites. At that time, the CODC's engineer specifically suggested the potential of connecting the State Highway 6 site to the Cromwell network, wastewater network, and then communications continued again in October with CODC. It is evident that not everyone in CODC that had an interest in this was fully informed, and that wasn't intended.
Okay. And talk us through the site selection of the State Highway 6 site, and also talk us through any alternative site selection process that you went through to narrow down the option of State Highway 6.
Yes. So in regard to site selection, that also started in March. Well, actually, it started several years ago with the identification of a complete network for Otago Southland, and sites were selected, and some investigation was done in 2015. But for this project, we started with a workshop in March, and that workshop was attended by the RTA. It was attended by NZTA and of course Otago Regional Council. From that workshop, we looked at the areas with feedback from the RTA members to identify some preferred areas that weren't site specific, and OPIS were engaged to investigate potential sites. Now, OPIS were set some criteria, which is that the stock truck effluent disposal site must be located wholly within the State Highway Reserve, that the site allows for safe entry and exit in both directions, that there are any conflicts with future work developments that NZTA may have planned for those areas. They were asked to consider environmental and social restrictions or implications of the site, and is it possible to landscape the site to improve visual amenity. From that report, OPIS actually recommended the State Highway 6 site that we're currently focusing on as their number one site, and there were a number of other sites that were viable throughout the area, including the State Highway 85 at Brass Knocker Road site. So we had another workshop with RTA, NZTA, ORC, and one of the transport operators that is particularly mobile in that area. And between those sites, we prioritised them, and then the RTA went back to their members with those priorities and asked for further feedback. And from that, we actually got including GPS tracking of stock trucks to show the movements. We received feedback from five or six operators that gave specific details of their preference, and there was an overwhelming preference for the State Highway 6 site that we are currently focused on. We certainly recognise the amenity value of that location. There was another site on State Highway 6 further down the road, but that would have had that was even closer to individual orchards and stalls. So we believed that a landscaping program around the stead would improve amenity, and then we went to communicate with the immediately adjacent landowners, and we spoke to We wrote a letter to them all and then spoke to the ones that were either immediately affected by being adjacent to the site on either side of the road.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Valentine. That sort of helps to paint a bit of a picture. But before we go to Councillor Kempton and Councillor Laws, I don't want this to turn into a design by committee, and I'm mindful that there's been a significant amount of work to get to this point. And I'm wondering whether there's an alternative forum to thrash out, for want of a better word, the way forward. So in other words, it's probably suggesting a workshop, something along those lines. But just wanted to put that out there. I'll go to Councillor Kempton and then Councillor Laws.
Yeah, just by way of background more than anything, as Councillor Bell has indicated, there are actually three issues associated with stopping for it.
Everybody needs to grab their microphone and stick it
there and then talk into it.
Just speak up.
As Councillor Bell has pointed out, there are three issues, but they are entirely separate issues. And we're only dealing with one here. And I think that, first of all, an effluent site anywhere on State Highway 6 has been signalled in our long-term plans and our two annual plans. And in fact, I recall putting out a map to all councillors about where they might be going in early 2016. And there seemed to be good support for this council continuing to fund the construction of this network. So we put that aside for the moment. Maintenance is quite another issue, which certainly we're very well aware of. It seems to me that some things we need to keep in mind is that this is actually going on property that's not owned by CODC. It's owned by NZTA, and we also need to understand that CODC are not paying anything for it. The Regional Council is paying for it, about half of it, and NZTA about the other half of it. It seems to me that there has been all the statutory requirements with respect to planning have been met. It seems to me that we have no objections from the adjacent landowners. I understand that a landowner that's not currently adjacent but one day might be, has said, it might not suit me. One of the things we need to be careful about is that we're not planning for maybes. You can't do that. It's quite difficult. If there is a gap, I think it is in CODC not fully understanding all of the elements that are necessary for the construction and operation of a site, of one of these sites, and why that's a sensible place for it. And I understand that there is some work going on at the moment to have that discussion with them. What I think is that it's important that we make sure that those discussions are held with CODC, that we take into account what their questions over the site as much as we reasonably can, but we're dealing with public safety and other things, and so in the end we have to do what is right and sensible as a compromise across all of people's needs. And in my view, this is not a governance issue to say that's where it goes finally. It's a governance issue to make sure that discussion with CODC has been had meaningfully and that that we have a full understanding of their views and theirs of ours, and we leave it to staff to finish it.
Thank you. Councillor Laws.
Councillor Noon, you started by saying we don't want this to get into a design by committee discussion.
Correct.
But that's exactly how these STEDs were put where they were, by committees. Just not committees of elected officials. The second thing is, also, Councillor Kempton, the reason we're discussing it is because this has now become a public issue. So if we left it to the officials again, it would still come back on our table because there is community upset and concern. Can I say, I've got a motion because I think we need to move on this issue, but I will say that it's in the wrong place. And for those of you who don't know the area, and that will be most of you, the reality is that this is a
slide.
Okay. I'm sure you don't know the area in detail, so it's not...
Fine.
It has a high amenity area. It's a high amenity and scenic area. It is one of the prime scenic areas on in that particular location. And indeed, in autumn, along that location, it attracts literally thousands of car units just to go to that area. I now know more about stock effluent than I ever wanted to know, having investigated this issue over the last 2 months, and they are filthy, and they are not well maintained. And I'm a bit disappointed that you would think of even putting one in an area that has high scenic value. I'm sure that the stock operators, five or six of them, think that that's the best place for them, but the reality is that the location of that area has much greater amenity value for literally thousands of people and potentially for tens of thousands of people who go past it. I would move that the ORC enter into discussions with the CODC, because it's pretty clear that there's a communication problem here. I don't know where it is. Our man says that it's in CODC. They say it's with us. It doesn't matter. We want to resolve the issue. With an aim to identify a mutually agreed ST or SEDT points and keep Dunstan Ward members informed. Again, I find it disappointing that as a Dunstan Ward councillor, I think the first I heard about this was from when it became public. It's not a criticism of the ORC. It could also equally be a criticism of the CODC that these things blew up before we knew. But there you go.
Okay.
That's the motion. That the ORC enter into discussions with the CODC with an aim to identify mutually agreed SEDs and keep Dunstan Ward members informed as to progress.
So, do I have a second?
I'll second.
Single by Councillor Bell. Now we'll just park that motion, just not for long, but I just need to go to Councillor Woodhead, and I assume you've got some information with us prior to the debate on the motion, or are you just going to launch into the debate, just so we're all clear?
No, I'll cover both.
Excellent, thank you.
So firstly, this is the completion of an Otago network that this council's been involved in from day one. And we haven't had the extra two sites in CODC for years because we haven't been able to agree on the maintenance or ongoing operation. The rest of the sites have been built, as you've explained, by NZTA and ORC, and then the local district council has taken over the operation of it. And stock movement patterns do change from year to year, but we're well aware that there are a significant number of cattle movements, particularly around the autumn and winter with dairy grazing, that move from Southland to Central Otago for winter grazing. And we know it is a safety issue, and we know the transport operators are looking for somewhere, to empty their tanks. These decisions, the funding of a steed at an ORC level dropped off our annual plan for a year or two, and it was reinstated, I think, 2 years ago or 12 months. We certainly had a discussion 12 months ago, so it was publicly consulted as part of our annual plan consultation. The decisions about funding it have been made. And we're actually lucky that NZTA have still kept the ability to fund their 50% in there, because it was way back in the early 2000s we did the first stages of the network. With respect to the ongoing funding of the operation, that has been discussed even at the Merrill Forum. And we asked the other councils, Dunedin City and Clutha, for example, to give us some sort of indication what it costs to operate these things. Unfortunately, they're stuck in very large wastewater budgets, and they just... We're talking $30,000 to $40,000 at the most. Some of them, Ray Junction's a very busy one, but for many of them, they just said it doesn't really matter. That did assist providing some comfort to Mayor Tim Cadogan that we're not talking of huge budgetary issues and massive quantities.
this one, if we could get it plugged into the Cromwell wastewater system, would be brilliant, because I'd imagine that means every truckload, it just disappears into the system. There's no great bulge when a truck comes and sucks it out and maintains it. So, I would like someone, Dr. Palmer or your staff, to clearly identify exactly where this site is, because my understanding is Councillor Kempton and I drove past it the other day. It looks like a perfect site.
Mr. Chairman, this site on State Highway 6 heading to Queenstown is on the right-hand side of the road between the motorsport park and the First Orchard stall. So about in the middle, it's immediately outside of 45 degrees south Cherry Orchard.
Righto, thank you.
We have spoken.
And there's a big row of poplars there, exactly. And quite a bit of space exactly. Between there and the road.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
So we're talking about a flat bit of concrete and a driveway to get trucks on and off the road safely, and an underground tank.
Hang on, please.
God.
Councillor Woodhead has got the floor. So does that complete your...
In my last comments probably indicate that I don't support... The process is underway, and it's up to staff. With the Road Transport Association, they're the key party in this. The neighbouring property owners have been consulted and approved. I've got one just down the road from... They're just a bit of flat concrete and a grid and an access way safe for trucks to come from both directions and cross the road. Absolutely critical. There'll be great sight lines down that straight to allow that to happen. And importantly, if they're travelling south, it's before they get into the hills and the gorges and where the roads are narrower and effluent is likely to be spilt off trucks. So I think it's an ideal site with that key link between Otago Southland on the western route, on the western part of our region. I'll leave it there.
Thank you. Through the speakers to the motion.
Can I have a right of reply then?
No, hang on. Are there any further speakers to the motion? Councillor Scott.
If you could just repeat the motion.
Sure. Oh, okay.
No,
hang on. We'll ask Lauren to do that.
Sorry, I can't hear that.
To identifying mutually agreed dead site and keeping Dunstan and Council conformed.
That's the progress.
Okay. Did anyone hear that?
Can I read it to you, Ella? That the Otago Regional Council enter in discussions with the Central Otago District Council with an aim to identify mutually agreed SED sites and keep Dunstan Ward councillors informed as to progress. Did you hear that?
Yes, thank you.
Cool. Just right
before. No, hang on. I'm just going to check whether there are any other speakers. No other speakers? I'll just make... Councillor Kempton.
Yes. I'm thinking here that the motion that has been proposed may well end up in stalemate on the basis that we're looking for both parties to agree. What the best we can hope for here, and in many similar situations, the best you can hope for is that both parties accept. Because there will be things that we might compromise on, there might be things that CODC say, the best result all round, yeah, we understand. So could I suggest an amendment to the motion which says that, and in my view, whether it's commencing or continuing discussion, just that discussion be held and that a solution be, I can't remember exactly the words, but replacing agreement with accepted by both parties.
Before I ask the mover and the seconder whether they accept that amendment, I'll just go to Dr. Palmer.
Through Mr. Chairman, just in that vein, I get a sense that between the staff of different parts of two different organisations, there might have been a little bit of confusion or conflation of some issues around disposal and siting and whatever. So whilst Mr. Valentine continues to liaise with the operating staff, I have been liaising with the acting chief executive at CODC, and we haven't been able to get together to talk about that just to make sure we're very clear around what it is that ORC is proposing and why. And so I've just had an email this morning from her that we're still committed to getting together to have a conversation along those lines.
I'm happy with that. So you're saying mutually agreed, you're saying accepted by both parties?
Accepted by both parties. Okay. The discussions are underway, and it's a matter now of ensuring that both parties understand all the issues and can come together to say, we understand, we accept.
The Chief Executive has just suggested that NZTA should effectively be in the motion as well, third party funder.
Just as a right of reply, the Cromwell community and the Central Otago District Council, the Cromwell community consists of 4,500 people, represented by their community board, and the Central Otago District Council have expressed their understandable concern as to the site of this particular issue. Now, for me, that's enough for us to enter into that discussion and to take those concerns seriously. So this motion is a reflection of that as well. There's also a desire to get to a mutually acceptable position.
Fair enough.
I'll put the motion, and I think we might be better to call for a division just so that it's okay, Lawrence.
So have we amended the wording of the motion or not?
Yes, we have.
We don't need a...
And including the NZPA, yeah?
Yeah.
Correct. Sorry, I should have gone to confirm that.
So it's not an amendment, Mr. Chairman, it's amended motion.
It's an amended motion.
Okay.
Sorry. Actually, just for clarity, I'll ask Lauren...
Yeah, that's what I need to clarify, because I'm unsure.
I'll ask Councillor Laws to read the motion again.
My understanding. Okay, sorry.
Including NZTA.
Oh, okay, including NZTA.
Okay.
All right. The Otago Regional Council enter in discussions with the Central Otago District Council and New Zealand Transport Authority. Name to identifying an acceptable siting of SEDs in the district, in the Central Otago District, and keep Dunstan Ward councillors informed as to progress. Is that right, Trio?
Okay.
That's fine. I think, and I think we're well down the road. I think this just tidies up the process. That's all.
Thanks very much.
Okay. I'll call for a division that if it needs to be called for. And Lauren, have you got the appropriate list to follow, or this week?
Okay. So
The only thing is that was the NZTA, New Zealand Transport Agency.
So it should be NZTA?
Yes.
Okay. So CODC and NZTA.
Lovely.
The name to identifying an acceptable site of mutually agreed deed site and to keep that Ward Council informed as to progress.
Mutually agreed, it was...
Accepted
by all parties.
Accepted by all parties, Well, mutually acceptable is probably it, Trevor.
Oh.
Yeah. That would mean that they all...
Now that's been massaged, do we need to have a division?
Well, if one calls for one, we don't have to have one.
Yeah, that's right.
Put the motion.
All right.
The motion.
Okay, I'll put the motion. All those in favour, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Against? Carried unanimously. Thank you. Right, moving on to item 7. Thank you very much, Mr. Valentine.
I guess stay Chris.
Okay. Oh, Chris Goff. Sorry, Mr. Valentine, with regards to the Leaf Flood Protection Scheme. Is there any...
Take it as read.
Okay, no worries at all. Any questions with regards to item 17? No?
Well,
excellent.
Yeah,
marvellous.
Good progress.
We have now got a motion, this report be received.
Another move that, Director's
report and noted. Moved by Councillor Woodhead, seconded by Councillor Hope. Any discussion? If not, I'll put the motion. Those in favour, please say aye. Against, carried. Now, moving on to the reports. Thank you very much.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Councillor Brown.
What are the domestic arrangements from here on in? Because the meeting's taking a long time and I'm not available to chair the Finance and Court up to 22. Doesn't seem as though we'll be through this.
Change.
After 22. elected. So the time now is
10 past 12.
Well, that's probably an that's probably an incentive to keep moving. I'll just check with Councillor Brown. Would you prefer that we broke and had a spell, so then we move on to finance, so then you're free to...
Well, the order could be changed, I guess.
Yeah, the order of the day, finance and corp is next in the order for the day.
Yes.
But we were assuming that we'd probably that we'd be through finance and corp before 2 o'clock. We could change the order of the day to put finance and corp later in the order.
So Councillor Brown is coming back later on. Oh, okay. So what time would you be available again?
Oh, 3 o'clock.
3 o'clock. Okay. So we'll just box on, and if we finish prior to 3 o'clock, we'll move on to the next committee. Is that? No.
Yeah, prior to 2 o'clock. We've got lunch scheduled for 12:30.
Yeah, sorry. And then once lunch was completed, we could just amend the agenda, surely, to allow Councillor Brown to return. Okay, let's keep moving.
Please,
right, climate change adaptation. Mr. Palmer, any comments as to the involvement you have nationally?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. I'll largely take this item as read. The intention here is for committee to note the release of two reports that are very relevant to functions and activities of Council, and it was also timely to bring this report given the change in government and just a reaffirmation of priorities as the government and officials see it with respect to climate change and climate change adaptation in particular. The first of those is the stocktake or interim report of the Climate Change Adaptation Technical Working Group, of which I am a member, and I have briefly summarised that there and just noted that there is some comment there about local government as a sector and other sectors, and that the group is working on a second report on options to how to deal with the barriers and other issues arising from the stocktake that the group undertook. In the terms of reference required, that be reported to the Minister by March. And the second report, Mr. Chairman, is the Coastal Hazards and Climate Change Guidance for Local Government. That's been around for quite a while, and the new government has released that, and I've noted there that it's going to be used for the work we're undertaking with Waitaki District Council on plan change provisions with respect to coastal issues. So happy to take any questions.
And just noting that those attachments were circulated electronically, so you've got a copy of those. Questions, queries, discussion? Councillor Scott, then Councillor Robertson.
Yeah, simply to make the point in the attachment where it says that many councils, for example, let's talk about South Dunedin, what it says in this report says many councils realise the importance of acting on adaptation, would like to do more, but identified barriers include lack of leadership and support from central government. And actually, and elsewhere it talks about issues with central government, that the fact that central government action on adaptation has been reactive to climate change as opposed to proactive. Other issues is limited community buy-in and resourcing constraints, funding capability and capacity. Yeah, so it just seemed to me reading that, you know, like it was sort of summing up. It seems to me anyway, a few fundamental structural issues that are there that, and I think Dr. Palmer's saying that you're looking at coming up with steps forward. And the sooner they are addressed, I think it will assist challenges like South Dunedin. It would be difficult to go ahead with criticisms like that. Is that fair, Dr. Palmer?
Well, through you, Mr. Chairman, yes. So the stocktake's identified barriers such as that, and the group is working on options for consideration by the government on how it might deal with that, and they'll be reporting to the Minister. The Minister, in due course, will release that report, and the government will make some decisions about what to do with that advice.
Yeah, so
as soon as that report is released publicly, I'll bring it back to the committee.
Great.
Thank you.
Thank you. Councillor Robertson.
I was just going to quickly note that although the guidance is non-statutory at the moment, we probably will see that changing over time, no doubt, but also noting that the regional policy statement for this council will become statutory and that it reflects some of those principles. And does set a sea level rise scenario for Otago as well. So, Yeah, we all have a statutory approach.
Thank you. Councillor Kempton.
Just a couple of questions. I guess the first one is the guidelines I thought were really...
I'm sorry, I thought the guidelines were really very helpful for me, but I was interested to know whether Dunedin City, for instance, has had any... whether there have been any signals about whether Dunedin City and ORC may well apply those in the manner in which you're talking about WDC and ORC applying them. Has there been any indication yet, or is that just too early?
Through Mr. Chairman, so we're well advanced in terms of collaboration on natural hazards provisions of district plan through 2GP.
Yes, indeed.
But I think it's timely to reflect on that and what further we might do together, having regard to this new guidance and on matters like South Dunedin and elsewhere in Dunedin City. Mm. So, yeah, time to reflect.
The second one, if I might, related to the task force paper, and I guess the question is for me whether there is any commonality between the current thrust of LGNZ, particularly talking about central government agency commission or something like that, and the thinking of the task force, or whether in fact there has been any significant talk between the two. I can't remember seeing that in the report. It was a big report, but
So through you, Mr. Chairman, local government New Zealand is represented on the climate change group.
Okay, thank you.
Councillor Lawton.
Thank you. Yes, it's good to see the support. It's a long way to do, and hopefully it's an indication that the government can take some leadership in the, particularly around providing the framework that are going to be able to standardise how climate education worked on by local government. One of the questions I had for Dr. Palmer was interesting in terms of the table on page 8 of the report, which is the predictive magnitude and variation of climate change. I'm interested to know, in terms of the current data, whether or not it reflects the likes of time frame of change now under daily temperature extremes, there are no significant changes observed. I wonder what this year's extremes in terms of weather are going to do to those current climate projections.
Good question.
Has there been any thoughts to that yet?
Dr. Palmer?
I don't have an answer for that. I report you're referring to was published in 2006, so it would have used data up to obviously no later than that year. It's a question I will put to the experts around whether the current situation changes any of the observations around what's happening now. And report back. Yes.
Excellent. Thank you. Any other questions, comments, Councillor Laws?
I was going to follow exactly Alice's point, and that was, and I just want to flag it now, and you tell me where it's going, and then they'll be fine. Gavin, we've done a whole lot of minimum flow and water plans based upon climate that are, I imagine, historical data in the Otago. And I'm sort of getting a little bit, I just want to flag it now because I'm getting a bit concerned or anxious that data is out of date already and that we haven't factored climate change in the Otago region into our planning and into our policy. And I'm not sure that we should be waiting for the government to come up with some guidelines when at the end of the day we know we're going to have to do it ourselves. Can I just flag that with you and get your response to that?
Through, Dr. Palmer. Through Mr. Chairman, so in the context of setting of minimum flows, climate change potentially alters the relationship between the hydrology or flows and values, ecosystems amenity. It also potentially alters the relationship between hydrology flows and surety of supply reliability. at present the science is not sufficiently advanced to make predictions of what those changes in relationships might be at a place in a river in Otago. And then to have an approach whereby the minimum flow today is X, and then it moves to X plus or minus some other figure in 10 years' time. There just isn't the science to support that kind of sophisticated, adaptive approach and to codify it in that fashion. So that dynamic situation is handled by monitoring and review. And so we continue to measure flows and hydrology at all the places where we set minimum flows. And if we detect changes in those relationships, which might be due to climate change or they might be due just to natural variability, then we make a plan change. And we're required to review plans every 10 years anyway. So that's a very short time frame compared to the kind of decadal changes you might expect. So that's a kind of adaptive management approach to adapt to changing climate, changing understanding of climate, and all the other factors that affect minimum flows like socio-economic matters. So that's where it's at the moment, adaptive management. And that's similarly how we handled the flooding of it as well, you know. Continue to monitor, adapt, and have processes that allow you to do that until such time as we've got reliable predictive capability in the future.
Are you confident that we've got that process underway?
Yes, I am. Yes. Yes.
Mr. Chairman,
can I follow on from that? That's a great point. There's one that I would follow up with. Just highlighting, for example, the Nimbus River this summer is bone dry in a large, much larger area than I understand than what we would have expected. So the great point might be interesting that we could be more proactive in that adaptive model that you're talking about.
Thank you. Councillor Deacon.
I was just going to say that I thought Councillor Law's question was a really good one, and Dr. Palmer's answer was really well prepared, thorough, and very reassuring. But I'm still thinking there's room there for us as a council to be a bit more thoughtful about the rate of adaptation that we might choose to make, especially when setting minimum flows in vulnerable rivers. And Councillor Lawton's just reminded us of one of our most vulnerable. The 10-year interval seems to be a very long one. I know that the difference between climate and weather is 35 years. You know, climatologists don't work on an annual basis. Climate is the average of 35 years of data. So we can't take climate data as our determining factor without a high level of risk, especially at a time when climate is clearly changing quite rapidly. So the point I'm making is that the 10-year review, that is reassuring to an extent, but I think given our region and its vulnerability and the nature of so many of our water flows, we should consider, if the REMA allows it, setting a 5-year review interval. That's the only point I wanted to make.
Thank you. Any comment?
I take the point, which is about have we got our frequency of review and places we're looking at for review well lined up where we think the changes are most likely to happen. So, yeah, that's something we'll give more thought to.
Yeah, I think so.
Councillor Kempton.
I think one of the things that ought to go into that that process is I think we need to recognise that one of the biggest factors around setting minimum flows are socio-economic factors, and those things are extraordinarily difficult to predict. For instance, and I'm not suggesting I'm thinking out loud here, in 30 or 40 years' time, we might find that the public are very, very happy to see rivers sucked dry because there are food shortages and there's this and that and there's an air of desperation. I'm only making that up. But what I'm saying is that there is room for significant changes in how we as a region value water. So I think it's the socioeconomic that will have the biggest bearing on how these things get set. And I just wonder whether 5 years, 10 years, I mean, that's really quite difficult to pick those things up. It's just something that's added into the mix.
Dr. Palmer.
Yeah.
That's what I was thinking.
Yeah, so one way is a kind of a calendar-based approach. The other is how will we know that change is happening more rapidly than we thought it was, and that's a different sort of trigger that we should think about. Get a bit more sophisticated about surveillance and what's happening to our environment, not only the physical environment, but the socio-economic one as well.
Absolutely. Yeah. Thank you.
So I'd like to move the recommendations A, B and C. Moved by Councillor Robertson, seconded by Councillor Hope. The report be received, the findings of the climate, you understand them all. I'll put the motions, A, B and C. All those in favour, please say aye.
Aye.
Against, carried. What I suggest is that we break for lunch now, reconvene at 1 o'clock. We have the report, Manage the Use of Coal for Domestic Heating, Otago and New Zealand. This is the report we called for late last year. We'll take the report as read. Welcome, Ms. Mills.
Thank you.
Thank you for the report, and I'll just scoot around the table to see whether there are any queries, questions, etc. Any questions for Ms. Mills? Councillor Hope.
I have an interesting question for you, Dr. Mills, and it's to do with not so much what we see now, but what's going to happen probably soon. Because, as we all know, the lakes are low. There's not a lot of water. So, you know, could this be something where we may have a bigger trend this year in coal use over winter, because, you know, there may be the fact that electricity could be low. I don't know. I could be completely wrong in my thinking. But we haven't got a lot of water in our lakes. Therefore, perhaps we don't have a lot of water to generate electricity. Maybe the coal use this year could be of greater use. It's just, I just suddenly thought of that before. Maybe we could just perhaps discuss that a little.
Yeah, through the chair. I think there are probably a lot of factors that flow on to how much wood is used, how much coal is used. It's certainly how much electricity is available and cost. Wood availability at times. There's not enough wood available to last the entire winter. Maybe people turn to coal. So I think there are a lot of factors. They're very hard to tease out, but it's certainly something to be aware of and to watch the bigger scenario. Yes.
It's not like we can just write coal off here, is it, really? Because of just, as you say, it can be seasonal as well. Maybe next 2 years it could be dry like it has been and it might come right. I don't know. We all don't know. But they're just alluding to that factor that coal could be in high, or wood could be in high demand this year, and therefore the levels could be the same or not greater.
That's right.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you. Any other queries, questions? Councillor Scott.
Well, it's not necessarily a question, but we're on the coal report, yeah?
Yes.
And I was one of the ones a period of time ago that said, hey, it's time we banned coal. It's ugly, it's dirty. We need to be a modern society. Surely there's a better way, more efficient way of heating our homes. This report did actually give me a number of surprises. The first one was that techniques used by councils to manage air quality, that none of the 16 councils actually banned coal use. And that was a little bit of a surprise to me, because I had wrongly assumed that there were some that had. But I think there are councils that, through other policies, effectively banned coal use through other policies. So, for example, in our region, for example, in Airshed 1, we effectively banned coal use in the air zone 1 through any new burner needs to be 0.7 and any historic or previous burner needs to be achieving 1.5. And I had a discussion with Councillor Laws before. Councillor Laws said, well, hang on a minute, some people are burning coal in air zone 1. And but that comes down to our compliance operation, Scott, yeah? Their compliance operation had some teeth, then that would not be happening, because their policy says it needs to be 1.5 for existing, 0.7 to be new, effectively. Deborah, you're saying that, you know, coal should not be happening in air zone 1.
That's correct, by the rules.
By the rules. By the rules that have been here, put in for quite a period of time, went through a transition time and so forth. But anyway, back to this issue, you know, the reason for the report is, okay, I'm convinced that maybe a bylaw to ban coal. Well, it certainly hasn't been done somewhere else, so we would have to be brave. Nevertheless, what initiated all of this was the fact that Milton was our worst. What our previous report basically said, or the one before the previous, that by most metrics, Milton experienced the poorest air quality of all monitored sites through the winter with 48 days. So we've got Milton in air zone 2 of having 48 days, whereas you compare that with the air zone 1, Arrowtown was less, number 42, Clyde was 23, and Cromwell was 42. And then if you compare Milton with other towns that we monitor in South Otago or elsewhere, the next worst is 14, Balclutha, which is significantly down. So we've got an issue with air quality in Milton. It's the worst, and we are not living up to our responsibilities for whatever reason. And does it have something to do with coal? Yes, it does. But maybe, from my perspective, you know, a blanket issue of no coal is maybe, with reflection, not the best way to go. My view is that we need to get on with it and fulfil our responsibility that Milton is an air zone 1 town. And that my understanding is that the characteristics for an air zone 1 town, that Milton is definitely in there. Is that correct?
Yes, it is.
That is correct. So what are we doing? And if we put Milton where it's supposed to be, then there will be a consequence over time of better air quality. There will be a reduction in coal when the appropriate transition time, and any new burners will have to be of a certain standard. And I think one thing that we've learnt with this air quality thing is that there is no silver bullet. You know, having a solution tomorrow ain't going to happen. And we reprimand ourselves with a lack of performance, but over the last 10 years or whatever, we still have nevertheless a reduction in PM10 of roughly 50%. And I think we should continue to strive for those incremental gains. And so what this report is saying to me, the conclusion to me, and I'm happy to move a motion, is that we seek a report about the appropriateness and implications of Milton being in air zone 1. That's what this report says to me.
Councillor Scott, I'll get you to write down that motion and give it to Lauren. I just want to make two comments. One, in the report it talks about the policy that the Otago Regional Council have got is a effects-based policy, and also talking about Milton, there has been a financial incentive for some years that the Otago Regional Council has, and then currently the program with the Otago, the collaboration with the Otago Homes Community Trust, they're looking at upgrading 50 Milton homes. That's all in the report. So I just wanted to say we're not sitting on our hands. But
well, maybe we are.
Point,
maybe we are. How effective is... No, no, you put your... I don't know why you're putting your hand up.
No.
Because we're saying that we have this this thing going on in Milton. The feedback that I get from the... I shouldn't say from the coal face, is that literally, even though we're providing some money and so forth, that it's still very demanding for the Milton people to actually enter that scheme in terms of take-up.
Okay. I just wanted to clarify there was some things we are doing, that was all. If you write your motion and give it to Lauren, then I go to Councillor Woodhead, then Councillor Robertson.
And then
Councillor Laws, and then Councillor Neal.
Let's make a feast. And was that Councillor Lawton wanting to speak to?
Oh, and then Councillor Lawton, after Councillor Neal.
Thank you. All right, I'll be brief. Thank you for a very good report. Puts it all in context. Look, we've made some progress. The start of this Clean Air program a number of years ago now, and we've gone off the ball is the wrong word, because the government's pulled the subsidy on insulation, and so the installation of clean heating appliances has slowed down after that first initial wave. But when you look at the graph on page 34, we're still well above in Waitaki, Central Otago, Queen, in all our districts,
well above the New Zealand average for coal usage. And so the question I have for reading Deborah's good report is, what is the trigger for the next step? How are we going to take the next jump? And yes, we've got a significant reduction in discharges, as Councillor Scott's mentioned, but if you drive through Milton on a cold morning, the place stinks. The issue for me is we've got our plan, but it's the compliance with it. And this is a difficult issue to comply with. We've discussed in the past, you put staff out tapping on doors at night, we're talking individual houses. It's, you know, I don't think we want to go down that road, frankly. I still believe that an airshed one towns, and the reason they're airshed one is that they have the criteria is they continually trip over the National Environmental Standard, is that for clarity, we should be banning coal. Because the policy says you shouldn't be using it anyway. You can't burn coal in airshed one and meet the discharge limits, correct?
Correct.
So banning wouldn't have any impact, actually. So let's be brave, push the barrier out a little bit and consult on banning coal in airshed one towns and Milton, which we decided years ago and was never formally done in the way of our plan change, Ms. Winder, is include Milton formally as airshed one. I think I'm correct in that too, aren't we? We just treat it as airshed one. It's not in a policy perspective locked into it.
That's correct. We don't entirely treat it like an air zone one town. We do offer subsidies, which originally started for air zone one towns. We are working through the Cozy Homes Trust on the 50 homes. That's right. One of the significant differences, though, is that in air zone two, it's a very passive type of management, and we're hoping that natural attrition in Mosgiel and Dunedin and other centers will mean that those towns will meet the NES. In Milton, that's not going to happen. Obviously, passive management is not going to happen, and the difference is we do not have a phase-out of older burners in air zone two towns. That's what's been somewhat effective in air zone one. Sure, there's more work to do, but that's the big difference between air zone one and two are the phase outs.
Thank you, Councillor Robertson.
I'd second the motion, but I think it would need to say that it came to the matter was referred to the policy committee for consideration.
Cool.
If the mover was happy with that.
Thank you.
But I would like to suggest second one, which is picking up on what's been said about compliance. I think it would be good to refer the matter to the regulatory committee too, to consider practically the compliance effectiveness, I suppose. I'm not sure the right words for this, but basically the issue is what we've already said, that to enforce what we've got already in Zone 1, which effectively does outlaw coal already, you can't burn them in the clean burning appliances at the moment, but enforcing that really tricky. So if we could have a paper from regulatory committee as well, looking at how they would actually enforce the regulations, that would be helpful. We have had before staff knocking on people's doors, look, you've got a smoky chimney here, mate. Have a look at your appliance. Were you aware that there's a subsidisation for Air Zone 1? Then we've talked to district councils. Could you please enforce, and they've come up against problems as well from their end with the building code and enforcing the actual instalment of the 0.7 when the standard's higher than that. So my feeling is whether we're outlawing coal or we're outlawing four burners, we would be going around knocking on people's door and saying, please can we see if you've got any coal here? Have you got a trailer load of it you've just bought from Southland because it's outlawed in Otago? Have you got an old burner in here that is currently lit? And how would we feel about that? How would we feel about that round the table? Because that's really what it requires. And then, not just how we would feel about it, how practically we would enforce that then. Because actually the standard is also what's coming out of the chimney causing the nuisance rather than the burner. So my feeling is once we've got the paper on practically what we would do for regulation, we would need to look at other approaches beyond banning coal or banning wood burners. And the other approaches will probably be education again, but I have a feeling it's going to be more subsidisation. If we truly want Air Zone 1 to install clean burners or heat pumps, we're going to have to pay for it as a community to make them do it, I think. Either that or we're going to be knocking on doors like policemen and checking if people are using their old burners. I don't think we've got the teeth to be able to even enforce it if we're doing that approach. So, I don't know how the mover of the first motion feels about the second one regarding regulatory.
No, I'm actually...
How about, before we go there, how about Councillor Robertson writes out your motion and provides that to...
Well, how about, Mr. Chair, a report to the Policy and Regulatory Committees regarding the appropriateness and the effectiveness of Milton entering Air Zone 1.
Oh, lovely. If you've written all that down and if that incorporates Councillor Robertson's points... in the meantime, you two work on that.
Yep, and we've
got it. Yep.
Just on relation to that, am I allowed to respond?
No, because I've got a sequence of speakers that I need to work my way through and you're going to get an opportunity to speak to your motion. Councillor Laws.
Oh, sorry. Yes, as a guilty party when it comes to burning coal, and you can prize my Ojai coal from my coal dead hands before I'll give it up, I have to say that there would be considerable unease in an area where the Otago Regional Council is looking to build its credibility in its community if it suddenly decided to adopt a draconian view on coal. I note there are no regional councils in New Zealand who ban coal use. Not one. There's a reason for that.
Councillor Laws, as I sense we're going to have an opportunity to speak to the motion, I was hoping we're going to work our way through, because each individual has indicated they want to, I assume, ask a question at this point.
Oh, you want
but if we're going to speak to the motion, let's hold that until the motion's on the table,
okay,
please.
Okay, then I'm going to ask the obvious question. Why? Why are we seeking to ban coal? Okay, and I've the only stuff that I've seen around here is a 10-year-old report on health, which didn't prove that anybody in Cromwell or Alexandra is encountering any deleterious health effects from current wood or coal burning policies.
Okay, the question why is probably an unfair question for Ms. Mills, but I think you're posing it to everyone else to think about. Is that right?
And the second question I'm going to ask is this. As a coal burner who buys coal commercially in Cromwell, Brian tells me I'm breaking the law. And presumably so is the major retailer who processes Ojai coal and 15 to 20% of Cromwell's population. Can I just explain, we burn coal for a reason, and that's to keep warm. And it is the most efficient form of heating for our particular household. That's why we do it. But I was not aware until my discussion with Brian that I was a lawbreaker. So can somebody clarify that you are not currently allowed to burn coal in Cromwell or Alexandra or anywhere else? Because it's sold commercially, burned commercially, heats our houses and homes and our schools.
Question to Dr. Palmer, or it's a compliance, is it one for...
Rule issue.
It's a
rule issue.
Is there a rule around what Councillor Laws has just raised, burning coal in Cromwell?
I couldn't tell you off the top of my head, but in terms of compliance, it is difficult because you can have a fully compliant burner and breach the air plan rules. Because as Councillor Robertson said, it's not so much the burner, it's what's coming out of the chimney. So you can have a fully compliant wood burner and burn wet wood and breach the rules. So it requires people to be generally walking around at night time, knocking on doors. The sense that I've had from council discussions in the past is we don't want people to go cold, so education is the way to go. We are working with Ms. Sutton's team on, particularly for the likes of Arrowtown, an education type approach. We would probably start with commercial operations such as bars and cafes. Everyone loves to stand beside the open fire after skiing, so that we might concentrate on stopping that. There will be community backlash, clearly. But if I get a steer from council that that's what they want us to do, then that's certainly what we will do. In terms of purchasing coal, I don't think there's a rule that prevents someone purchasing coal.
Okay, thank you. Councillor Neil.
Yeah, thanks, Mr. Chairman, and my colleague there's obviously sitting at the moment to have another crack at this.
Wow.
The debate will really be when further down the track when we bring this back to another committee, but I still want to wade in a little bit. I mean, our major role is to look after water and air. Now, I get really passionate about water and passionate about water that's trending the wrong way. This isn't trending the wrong way. This is actually going the right way. Why are we actually getting so excited about it? Even in Clutha, 27% decrease. So why is everybody, you know, getting so excited? It's a great report. Thank you very much, Sarah. And to me, I took a reasonable amount of heart from it. I'm not sure that we have to get too involved.
Thank you. Councillor Lawton.
Thank you. Given I've only been sitting around the table going on sort of 8 months, and this conversation's become quite comical, actually. We've had it a number of times in 8 months, and it seems we're still taking a very piecemeal approach to updating a current plan, which we are required to keep updated. Can we not have a clear plan of what needs to happen to ensure that this piece of policy is actually updated to a satisfactory level with all the relevant data and information that we might need, which I would suggest we need to have some better understanding around health impacts. It says in this report that there has been some research by EnviroNet, but it is quite old, it's 2004, around the health impact effects of the various substances in the air. So I just think we keep talking about needing it to go to policy and regulatory. We need to sit down as a council and figure out what the process needs to be to finally update this plan. And how are we going to implement it?
That
would be my motion, if I was to put one on the table. I will put that motion on the table. So also, I just wanted to highlight that I've sent an email around from Councillor Scott Stevens from the Queensland Lakes District Council Arrowtown Councillor. He was really disappointed to see that Arrowtown wasn't used as one of the examples, given its bad air quality. They realised there's only a very few number of people that are burning coal in Arrowtown, and they are absolutely convinced that they need the support and from the likes of the Cozy Home Trust to get to those people, and they will have a coal-free town if they were able to get some support from Otago Regional Council. That is our role. That is what we are expected to do in terms of having an active approach to all solid fuel burner replacements. So in the Air Zone 1. So I'd like to move an alternative motion that actually we have another look at what our overall process will be for renewing this plan and all the various committees that needs to go through and what additional data we need to collect. I don't have that written down.
Councillor Scott may have the ability to weave your suggestion into his motion, but we'll just let that bubble away in the meantime. But we take your point. I'm going to Councillor Deeger, then Councillor Kempton.
I was simply going to commend to everybody the
email from Councillor Lawton of about 20 minutes ago from Scott Stevens. It's well worth a read, and it increases the momentum that we seem to have, and I'm pleased to see it, to get rid of coal once and for all.
Thank you. Councillor Kempton.
Yeah, I just, in some respects, I see, I have some shared views with Councillor Lawton, and that is that we're going to revamp the air plan. The discussion that we're having today, from my perspective, is actually a good discussion with respect to what goes into that. Right? And I don't know that we need to screw the scrum too much with various ad hoc motionary today, but take on board the things that have been talked about. And the other thing that we still have is an unholy mess in the whole air situation between effects-based and prescriptive. We don't, and some of the things that we need to actually decide in the course of updating the air plan, and to some degree that's been worked on already, is whether we lead with effects and support with prescription where necessary, or lead with prescription and support with effects. And those are absolute fundamentals before we can go forward, in my view. And the other thing we need to be careful about is ban coal. The real issue, if we take the wood experience, is naturally aspirated coal burning, because we have stoves that burn wood that have a small force draft and are virtually emission-free. The coal technology is around to do that. So you have to be very specific about what we're doing. So to ban a fuel, full stop, is potentially shooting ourselves in the foot. So I think we're just getting a bit ahead of ourselves, and I'd very much like to see today's discussion as feedstock for the replanning process rather than ad hoc motionary, as I said, coming out today. I think it's really important.
Thank you. If there's no further discussion, Councillor Scott, have you delivered a written motion to Lauren? That
included? Well, I'd just like to, you know, bring this meeting to some type of agreement. Everybody's talking about banning coal. In terms of the motion that I verbalised, I didn't actually mention banning coal.
Councillor Scott, what I'm wanting to do is try and go to the next stage. So we need a motion on the table. Lauren needs to see the wording of it, and then, because I sense you speaking to the motion, so please. Just while I've got everyone's attention, the way we're tracking, it's likely that we are going to, when we finish the technical committee, we'll go to communications and then deal with finance later on in the day, simply because the chairman's needs to, he's got another commitment between 2 and 3. Okay, Councillor Scott.
Okay, just before I read out what Lauren has actually got, I'd just like to respond to a couple of points that was made. Councillor Neal says, hang on a minute, we're all tracking in the right direction. Actually, no, I'll read it out. The first point is to refer a paper to the Policy Committee for consideration for inclusion of Milton in Air Zone 1. Where coal's not even mentioned.
It's just the one motion?
And point two, it's a matter of ability to enforce the current regional plan air zone one provisions be considered by the regulatory committee.
Moved by Councillor Scott, seconded by Councillor Robertson.
Yeah.
Councillor
okay.
Scott.
Okay, so the word coal is not even in there. So let's get that one quite clear. And but the point in relation to councillor Laws, though, the computer's gone off, and I'll just read out what is in the report for all of us to read, is that in their zone one, it says that that the rules state that emissions from any appliance are to be less than 1.5 grams per kilogram. And my understanding is that that's not possible to be achieved if you put coal in it. Is that correct?
That's correct. The one exception to that is the Mackenzie boiler.
Yeah.
And it's, I think there's a second one now.
Yeah.
That have been tested. They were allowed in because they were tested in the laboratory and they met those emission limits. But yeah, those are very few and far between.
Yeah. So, you know, let's just understand this. This is, you know, a fact space. We're not saying you can't do this, you can't do that. What we're saying is at the end of the day, you've got to achieve a certain level of emissions. That in reality, Councillor Laws, next time you put coal in Cromwell, you won't be achieving. So that's the first point that I want to make. Second point that I like in response to Councillor Neal. Councillor Neal says, hey, we're trending in the right direction. And yes, we are, as a general statement. So I agree with that. But the point, this resolution is about Milton. Milton, in the last report, I say it again, that by most of metrics, Milton experienced the poorest air quality of all monitored sites this winter with 48 days. Somebody mentioned Arrowtown. Arrowtown has got less. Clyde has got less. Cromwell's got, they're all in air zone one. So, yes, I agree, Councillor Lawton, Councillor Kempton, let's do the strategic approach. But in the meantime, let's just keep our house in order because we're doing that area an obvious disservice. And so what this motion is all about is just a bit of housekeeping. We've known for years and years that they're in the wrong air zone, and we need some type of basis just so that we actually understand the appropriateness of this. So we're just doing some basic housekeeping. Secondly, as Councillor Robinson's pointed out, we are actually just reviewing the informants' processes. So if somebody does put coal in their burner, and this is not hypothetical, so I think Councillor Laws was saying, you know, what if we do this? What if we do that? This is the situation right now. If we do nothing today, we still have this regulatory challenge in Air Zone 1 about how we enforce our current rules. So it's timely to get that as well. Thank you.
Thank you. Councillor Robinson, did you want to... No, you were good. Speakers to the to Councillor Scott's motion.
I have it read out once more, please.
Okay.
So it's and I say it again, that this will complement a strategic approach that others are advocating. But one thing we do know is this strategic approach is not going to happen tomorrow. It's going to take a long time. So this is about basic housekeeping, about Milton, and it's about enforcing our existing rules. So the motion is to refer a paper to the Policy Committee for consideration and inclusion of Milton in Air Zone 1. Okay, Milton in Air Zone 1. And point 2, that the matter of ability to enforce the current regional plan Air Zone 1 provisions be considered by the Regulatory Committee. So the two separate matters. Very bit wordy, but the point's there.
Okay, you heard that okay, Councillor Lawton?
Yes, thank you.
Thank you. Any further discussion? If not,
I add then that given that we're already partway through reviewing this plan anyway, can we please just make sure we are moving along on the strategic level? Because I feel, you know, as I said, given I haven't been here very long, it's already become incredibly frustrating and I don't understand why we don't have that strategic foresight. So...
So,
can we actually include that as the third motion?
Very happy if
that's what's required.
That we progress our strategic approach, something like that.
Can we just perhaps just have a verbal update from Dr. Palmer with regards to the air strategy, where it's been notified?
Yeah.
Something
to continue with that.
Okay.
If I can, through you, Mr. Chair. So we have a draft air strategy. We've gone out to territorial authorities in the region to socialise that and get some feedback. We've had some feedback. We've also gone out to key stakeholders. The draft air strategy implementation plan has been included in the long-term plan, the draft long-term plan, and we agreed that we would go out for final consultation, strategy and the implementation plan together, so that the community can see the actions that we are proposing.
And the rough time frame?
In alignment with the long-term plan
Big pardon, sorry. Okay, everyone clear?
No.
Okay, so I will now put the motion if there's no other speakers. Everyone knows what they're voting on?
Yep.
Okay, so there's two motions. I'll put the first motion. All those in favour, please say aye.
Aye.
Against? Carried. The second motion, I'll put the second motion. For those in favour, please say aye.
Aye.
Against? Aye. Carried. So both motions carried. Now, we also have that the report be received. Councillor Scott, you happy to move that as well?
Sure.
And seconded by Councillor Robertson?
No.
I'll put that motion as well. All those in favour, please say aye.
Aye.
Against, carried. Thank you very much. Thank you, Ms. Mills. Moving on to the review of surface water state of environment monitoring. Another one of your babies, so to speak, Dr. Olson. You're a busy man. Now, I recall when we had the discussion about Lake Dunstan, this is where we're going to pick it up, correct? So I take the report as read. Any questions, comments? Councillor Robertson.
Great to finally have this report. Thank you very much for that. We've been looking forward to it. Just quickly, a couple of things that I was wanting to ask. Firstly, there seems to be quite a lot of emphasis put on the ability to compare different types of system, I suppose, or land use. So we currently have a less than representative network because we are unable to compare, say, lowland, rural type settings with the more pristine inland type settings, which we have less of. But I'm wondering whether ability to be able to compare within those is more important than ability to compare the two against each other, because we know that pristine environments are more pristine than lowland ones. So comparing the two, I know statistically at the moment perhaps we can't do it as well as we might, but whether comparing within them themselves is more useful. The second thing is I feel quite worried about losing some of those sites that we've had over time in those more lowlandy, over-represented areas. Yes, there's a cost thing, and yeah, we might have too many of them, you know, statistically, but actually which are the sites that we're going to lose, and would we regret doing that? I don't think I've got enough information. I probably haven't read in detail enough, sorry, Dr. Olson, but I feel a bit worried about losing some of them, especially given water plan provisions and the need to be closely monitoring. I know SOE is going to be just a trigger for more intensive monitoring for our water plan, but yeah, that's just a wee worry that I had, so I don't know if you've got any comments on that.
Through you, Mr. Chair. So I think it's important to distinguish between two components within the report. One was on representativeness, and that was the ability for us to make statements about the state of water quality in Otago on a regional basis, and that was more where the issue arose, where you had over-representation of lowlands, particularly in Receiving Water Group 1, versus particularly Receiving Water Group 3, which was underrepresented.
Mm.
So that's the reason for that shift, the issue around power within those receiving water groups is frankly less of a consideration, because by and large we actually have pretty good power, particularly for rural type settings. The main issue that was highlighted in there for us was the lack of urban sites, and it's, I think, always going to be a challenge in Otago. We don't have very large urban areas, and so often you've got sort of one or two main catchments that drain an urban area. If you start sampling every single little stream within those catchments, you start to essentially get pseudo-replication. So you've got, you know, a large number of sites, but they're all kind of measuring the same thing. So I agree with you that the ability to compare, really the emphasis of that representativeness component of the work was to be able to make really clear and non-misleading statements about the state of water quality in Otago, which is kind of a fundamental part of state of the environment. On your second point around the loss of sites from low, particularly lowland areas, this proposal was around what we're calling state of the environment monitoring. So clearly, you know, we've got quite a confined scope when we're talking about that. The proposal that's put forward in the paper around the different options as to how we implement this in our network would not result in important lowland sites being dropped. They would simply move out of the state of the environment network into a different network that's tagged to something like Clean Change 6A implementation. Yeah. So for the purposes of reporting at a regional scale, they wouldn't be part of the network, but we would still be monitoring them. And particularly the two of the main reasons for maintaining sites, one is for that, as I say, implementation of 6A and effectiveness of the rules therein. And the second one is really around the secondary part of SOE monitoring, which is around estuary water quality.
Mm.
So catchments, lowland catchments that we may have wanted to drop out of the state of the environment to get that balance, are going to be captured still, but with the purpose to monitor water quality inflow, the quality of water flowing into our estuaries. So it sounds like semantics. We're still going to be monitoring them, but I think it's really important to make state of the environment, the purpose of state of the environment, really clear, because otherwise we get into the same situation that we've had in the past, where you get a distorted view of water quality in Otago.
Thank you, Dr. Olson. I just wondered, with regards to the discussion we had earlier about Lake Dunstan, you talked about the reasons why Lake Dunstan was different to the Lake Wanakas, Wakatipu, etc. Do you want to make any comment, because we're about to have a discussion about the inclusion of Lake Dunstan potentially to be added in that group? Any comment? You know, the purpose, the value. Just park the cost maybe for a moment, but
in the plan we have five receiving water groups, and so those five receiving water groups are what we're calling, for the purposes of reporting against the NPS for freshwater management, we're calling our freshwater management units. That's the jargon that Wellington's using. So those five receiving water groups are essentially, subdividing here, South Otago, receiving water group one, the rest of the rivers of central and north Otago, which is receiving water group two, the tributaries of the Alpine Lakes, which is receiving water group three, receiving water group four, which is all the other lakes, and receiving water group five, which are the big Alpine Lakes. Now, Lake Dunstan, in the plan, is included in receiving water group three. So it's actually included in with the river, the Clutha River, and the reason for that is because in terms of the management of water quality in it, and also the effects of changes in water quality, it acts essentially more like a very, very large pool on a river because of its short residence time than a large alpine lake.
Okay, thank you. Further questions? Councillor Scott, someone had their hand up.
Yeah, I don't want to talk about the lakes.
I want to talk about the rivers. And there's been three options that have been presented here in terms of the state of the environment network for the rivers. There's option one, option two, and option three. The first point I'd like to make, you know, is Dr. Olson was talking about, you know, misleading statements. I mean, at the end of the day, any statement, for example, that I made was based on, you know, the SOE sites, with 39% of those sites are either poor or fair. And okay, depending on how you interpret that information. So I accept that what this report is about is to get something that is statistically reasonable and representative. And I find that, I can't argue with that. But when you look at the, you know, the plan that's actually, figure one, that's actually there, that if we were to stop beating around the bush and you look at actually the monitoring sites that are there, you know, South Otago is basically poor and fair, you know, as general statements. And the up, you know, where it's intensive agriculture and up in the lakes is good or excellent, you know, and that's probably the best type of sort of statements to sort of make, as opposed to sort of trying to average the two of them. I make as a comment. But my bottom line is building on what Councillor Robinson said, is that I will not support any of these blooming options if we're going to remove water quality sites that need to be used for 6A, and particularly in intensive agricultural areas. So what I'm saying is we go for option one, two, or three for the state of the environment. That's fine. You haven't actually, it's difficult to find out what's coming in or what's actually going out. But, and to our new chief executive, I will say, and it won't be the last time I ask for it, is, you know, a plan in terms of the implementation of 6A and the river water quality about, you know, what sampling are we actually doing, and how are we facing up to achieving the milestones that are in our water plan for 2020 and 2025. So do I get some type of assurance, Dr. Palmer, Dr. Rolson, that, for example, option two or option three is not stepping back on our monitoring responsibilities for 6A, and that at some point that will be detailed?
Mr. Chairman, I can answer that question initially. Whilst there is some rationalisation of some sites, and Dr. Rolson can give some examples of that, this changed way to reporting on the state of the environment won't compromise the monitoring and reporting we will do around 6A and catchment specific water quality. Dr. Olson can probably elaborate on that. And so, for example, the South Otago sites will continue.
Yeah, so the current network is 65 sites. That's why option one starts off at 65 sites.
Yeah.
But you'll notice for option one, it's 65 state of the environment sites, 6 urban SOE sites, and 13 other long-term sites. Now, those 13 other long-term sites are sites that we were dropping out of the SOE network that we've made the judgment to keep as part of our, particularly 6A and estuary monitoring.
Okay.
So in section 4.1, you'll see in option 1 there's 13 other long-term sites, option 2 there's 11, and in option 3 there's 10. Those are those sites that you're concerned about losing. It's also presented in table 1.
Yeah, so I know this is about the state of the environment, but because, you know, my concern about getting some statistical data across the region to implement their water plan, which option should I actually be going for? Is it option three? Should I be conservative and say, but is it option three or is it option two? And the cost difference between option two and option three was, what was that? It wasn't a lot, was it?
Well, 40K. 2,000,
43,000 or something. Yeah, 40. So, I mean, you know, from where I sit, we should be just going for option three for the, you know, with all the work that we do, this is our science, underpinning our science.
Yep.
That's the question I was going to ask, Mr. Chairman.
Chris Gold.
We've got this report, but I would have expected the recommendation on this particular issue to be made by this committee today. Is that correct?
I beg your pardon?
The options, I would have expected us to be making that decision today.
Correct. That's the recommendation.
So the staff recommendation is essentially...
Option three.
Option two.
And the reason... vote on that today, though.
And that was the option that was workshopped, that was taken, that was the staff position when we workshopped it in November, just off the top of my head.
But this may sound a silly question, but option two compared to option three, which is the better deal for 6A?
There's no wrong option. It is a judgment call. Now, if you were wanting to target monitoring for 6A, then I would say keep state environment a separate issue and target it just site specifically for plan change 6A purposes, and then whatever number you choose is the right number. But I don't think these three options are really just putting forward three ways of implementing the recommendations by NIWA. The 90 gives you more coverage of the region.
It's probably something we can cover off with the LTP tomorrow. We can maybe just go into a bit more depth where the gaps are and the priorities, etc.
Are you proposing option three then?
The option that I've costed is in the thus far for the LTP is option two.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I'm happy to move on that basis. But with a third recommendation, that you provide us, where the heck is it? But a third recommendation that you provide us with a report on something for 6A.
Okay, write that down, please, Councillor Scott, and note, please, because what we want the words the councillor moves. Okay, we don't want to just throw it to Lauren and expect to pick up every word.
Notice the words I use. It's what I mean.
Just could have done half of it by now.
Think of an answer.
Please. Councillor Laws.
I've got a question. The difference between option two and option three is 17 sites. Now, I've heard your option two, your answer to Gretchen. But I want to know what, for $60,000, which is a paltry amount of money, what we'd be missing out on by not having those 17 sites monitored?
The major consequence of that would be you would have fewer sites, particularly in the Alpine Lakes tributaries. As you'll see with the, and as I referred to before, when I was talking about the other long-term sites, we're shifting some sites out of SOE and into that other bucket of sites. The more sites you add, i.e. option three, which has 90 sites, it means the fewer that you have to shift out in order to get that balance right. So that's why option three was put up, was basically as the kind of the...
Is that like the optimum level?
Well, it's the least disruptive to our current network of sites. We'll still have to shift some. But really, what you're going to see is a lot more sites up in those sort of dock estate dominated catchments of the three major tributaries, and that's, if you've got a good imagination and a good eye, that's evident in figure four. You'll see there's just more points at the heads of those lakes. There will also be some relative change in receiving water group two as well. And in receiving group one, you'll see fewer sites getting dropped out of the SOE.
Well, I'm going to ask this next question. It may be rhetorical, I don't know. Surely having more sites at a time of rapid climate change and at a time when we are seeking to impose
significant change upon water use in our catchment is a better thing than having less. Could you answer that?
More data is always better.
Yeah, when so you, more when data you... is $60,000 extra a year.
Well, we should just go for option three then.
Well, if there's something written down for Lauren, then we all know what's being moved and seconded.
But that wouldn't do any harm anyway.
Are there any further questions for Dr. Olson?
Very quickly, after listening to Dr. Olson, I'm now more comfortable with option two, actually, but 6 to 1/2 times the other. What it wasn't clear to me in the report was there's a lot of sites we do for monitoring outside of state of the environment. And correct, Dr. Palmer.
Mr. Chairman, yeah, we monitor water quality in lots of places. And some of those sites, many of them, are for SOE purposes.
Yes.
And others are for 6A purposes. And some of there's commonality between those. And I think what we need to do is get some clarity for you around that TOTO.
Which does which.
To assure you that in addition to the SOE stuff, we are still doing intensive monitoring of places that don't fulfil an SOE purpose, but fulfil another important purpose around the effectiveness of 6A.
Yeah.
And we need to bring in information.
Shouldn't we actually park this? Park this until we get the totality, 6A SOE. Otherwise, we're in the dark.
Yeah.
And that the motion should be that from this, that instead, that a report be provided on targeted enforcement monitoring outside of the SOE and the SOE. And the SOE.
Well, I think what Gavin's just said is the motion, isn't it?
Could you just repeat what you just
said?
What
did you say?
Sorry.
We bring a report on ORC's freshwater water quality monitoring with detail on purpose, something like that.
6A and the SOE.
And then we would... Yeah, I think that's it.
Perfect.
Yeah.
I'll move that.
So with details on purpose
of that monitoring. Purpose of that monitoring.
Yep. That's right. I'll have second that.
Okay. Moved by Councillor Scott, seconded by Councillor Woodhead. But just in a moment, I'm going to ask Lauren to read it out so everyone's comfortable.
Thanks, Michael. Thanks, Gretchen. Yeah.
You're on the right
track.
Cole?
I hope the ones that the councillors on my left were listening. Cause
we've got
I'll put the motion. All those in favour, please say aye.
Aye.
Against? Carry. Thank you very much, everyone. Moving on to the review of groundwater information and models.
Can I? Did you?
Can I just go back to Councillor Scott? So the motion you moved, does that replace the ones on the audit paper?
Yes, it does.
Right. So there's a bit of an issue here, I think. Dr. Palmer. So... Do we need...
Report's noted.
Some further, the report needs to be noted, and that doesn't steer us in any particular way in terms of options.
Yeah, well, we can't determine the options.
No.
Can I just note that I wanted to abstain because I couldn't hear the motion being passed at all?
That's all right.
Well, you've got a beef with four councillors sitting on my left. Sorry.
Mr. Chairman, for planning purposes, we've assumed option two.
I think
for the moment we just need to flag a possibility that it might, a financial provision for that might increase as a consequence of a further decision. So I think in our draft LPP, we just need to note that that's something where we might need an extra $60,000 or $70,000 depending on some decisions.
And that report, can it come to next committee round? You've got the SOE data.
Definitely.
We've got time.
Councillor Scott and Councillor Woodhead, you're happy to move that this report is noted?
Yes.
Okay, moved and seconded.
Yeah.
Any discussion? If not, I'll put the motion of those in paper. Please say aye.
Aye.
Against? Carried. Moving on to the review of groundwater information and models. Dr. Olson, we'll take the report as read.
Sorry.
Any questions, comments?
We're going to have the late Dunstan one.
Oh, Lord, we were too. My big pardon. And you've given Lauren... Yep. Sorry. Just park that thought about that groundwater information models. We'll go back to the previous item. Lauren, are you able to read out Councillor Law's motion regarding including Lake Dunstan in the...
Lauren's got the word.
Yes.
That a paper be received and, with the adding of Lake Dunstan, those lakes monitored by the ORC be made available to the next committee round and include information on hydro lakes monitored in the region.
In other regions.
In other regions.
Yep, as a comparison.
Excellent. Have we a seconder?
Yep.
The second by Councillor Deaker. Any discussion? If not, I'll put the motion. All those in favour, please say aye.
Aye.
Again?
Aye.
No.
Do you want that recorded, Councillor Woodhead? No. A motion carried by majority. Now we're moving on to the groundwater information and models. Dr. Olson. We're taking a report. Sorry.
Yep.
any queries? Someone like to move the report?
Yes, I will, Mr. Chairman, and I'm just making a comment.
Moved by Councillor Woodhead, seconded by Councillor Brown.
Groundwater is a bit of a dark art, and I was pleased with how positive this independent review of our groundwater monitoring was of our current program. And so that's quite pleasing for me, because it's quite a complex thing to understand. And we've had lots of discussions on it, and lots of, we've always had groundwater scientists or two, and it's an important part of the water picture. So, I clicked through the actual technical report and was pleased with their comments. So, happy to move the recommendation.
Seconded by Councillor Bell. Is there any other comment, Councillor Hope?
Yes, could I just... alert us to the last page. We talk about Kingston and Glenorchy Aquifers. Am I right here, what I read, that we actually haven't done these before? Is that right?
There's Olsen? Currently one monitoring bore in the Kingston Aquifer, is my understanding, but there's no long-term monitoring site in Glenorchy. That is currently provided for in the LTP in year one. Still.
Thank you.
So, given that we've had some trouble up in Glenorchy with some readings of high E. coli and things like that, that would form some sort of basis to help with those readings. Is it anywhere near there? Do we put that where will, you know, is it going to be situated where? Just to give us a bit of an idea, please.
Yeah, so I guess, again, this comes to the purpose of state of the environment monitoring versus more detailed investigations. State of the environment monitoring is part of, gives you indications where there might be site-specific issues, but it's never going to be able to be done at the level of intensity to give you really detailed site-specific information. It is sort of long-term monitoring across groundwater, in this case across the whole region, to get to general patterns of change through time. More detailed investigations are probably required to get a handle on the issue that you're referring to. In saying that, though, there is probably, you know, there has been a need identified for a long-term state of the environment monitoring bore or bores within both these aquifers, given the likely change that's forecasted in terms of population growth and the like. So
in both of these, Kingston and in Glenorchy.
Yeah, and also changes that are being planned around wastewater treatment options.
Yes. I was going to ask you that about Kingston, that was my next question to follow on. Are they still on septic tanks?
Both those areas are currently on septic tanks, but my understanding is that both are planned to move to reticulate.
Yes. Through the Chair, may I ask just one more question?
Sorry.
Dr. Olson, just... Councillor Bell and I were concurring before, on page 55 of 74, it's the Claybourne Aquifer. It's just the word, I'll read it to you, you'll know straight away, it's just for us to have a handle on it. It just says to allow some early warning if that through flow may be declining. What does the through flow mean? Is that like continuous?
Yeah, so the clay-bound aquifer, which is just near Alexandra, the clay-bound aquifer discharges to, there's a series of aquifers in that area, and the clay-bound has flow that exits that aquifer that goes into another aquifer.
Yeah.
I can't remember which one that is.
Yeah.
So it's that connection, that through flow of water from the clay bound into that other aquifer that's referring to.
Yeah.
Just a kind of linkage between those two aquifers.
Thank you for
that.
Most of that water that supplies the Dunstan Flat, I always be led to leave coming down off the Elgin Range. Is that, so what you were saying, that's the other aquifer next door that through flow goes? Or?
There may well be other sources of recharge, but there is, based on our understanding of the aquifer at the present time, there is also a direct connection between the clay-bound aquifer and the Dunstan Flat aquifer. Which is quite common, you know, where you have aquifers, particularly where they overlie. Sometimes they're permeable, sometimes one discharge into another.
Yeah.
So just referring to that connectivity between the two.
Okay, it's been moved and seconded. Do you want to speak to the motion, Councillor Scott?
Yeah. Just briefly, I mean, it's already been said that the state of the knowledge available for the Otago aquifer is very good, so that's great. And I just want to emphasise that, yes, we do need to complete the gaps. So, you know, the various priorities, monitoring requirements have been put in here. And in relation to the Kingston and Glenelg, that's already been raised with Councillor Hope, it doesn't actually say what the priority is for that. All the others, you've got high priority, medium priority, low priority. And when it comes to Kingston and Glenelg, it doesn't actually say what priority it actually is. And I know, for example, that there's a huge population growth proposed for Kingston. We need to carry on. Well done, and we need to carry on.
Thank you, Councillor Scott. That's probably just a typo, is it? That it hasn't been prioritised some way, shape or form?
Yeah, I'm not sure I can look at that.
Okay. Been moved by Councillor Woodhead, seconded by Councillor Bell. I'll put the motion that the report is noted. All those in favour, please say aye.
Aye.
Against?
Aye.
Carried. Thank you. Moving on to the Roxburgh Debris Flow.
I'll cover this, Mr. Chairman. Dr. Payan and Dr. Mackey are away dealing with the weather right now. This is their work. So this is really just an interim report for you on what we know and what we're doing about the Roxburgh debris flow hazard. I'll just draw your attention to page 72, just before conclusion, where we talk about the need to establish target or design cross-sections for these creeks and then to be very clear about how they function from a sediment storage conveyance point of view and then clarify maintenance requirements and responsibilities. So that's a piece of work we need to do collaboratively with NZTA and CODC. And the second thing is just that we've had some preliminary discussions with Central Otago District Council about how do we go back to the community to inform them of this and what we're up to. And Ms. Sutton has some work underway jointly with CODC just to flesh that out.
Yep. Dr. Palmer, I just had a question around the previous events that are talked about in the 70s and the 78 and et cetera, the data that's been collected. Does that exist in the Central Otago District Council's LIM regime? Like that information, does that exist there? So if someone was purchasing a property in Roxburgh, close to this sort of potential hazard area, would they be aware of it if they sought a LIM?
Mr. Chairman, we would need to check as the specifics of what CODC provide, but certainly this information is on the Otago Natural Hazards Database, and where we got to with the territorial authorities about 6 or 7 years ago is an understanding that when it came to their LIM processes, their staff would utilise our database. So I think there is a mechanism for getting this stuff to customers,
yep.
But it's the kind of thing I can follow up with.
Okay, thank you. Questions for Dr. Palmer? Councillor Hope.
Thank you. Dr. Palmer, Can I ask you to look at page 61 or 74? It's that picture there, please. And where we've got figure 4. Can I ask you a question? It's two-pronged, please. It's my understanding there's been some local concern in the Roxburgh area that the hill's been developed into grassland. It has gone to the native tussock. If the native tussocks were there, would they have been beneficial in slowing down the intense rainfall from the steep hill?
What a good question.
In other words, we've got the tussocks, it's been taken away, now we've got the grass, and you can see by that there. I mean, if the likelihood of it happening again is... That's my first question to you. Can I say my second one now, because it may answer it? Which is the second part. Is there a land management plan with regards to the development on those hills?
Through Mr. Chairman, I don't know the answer to your first question, but the intention is to bring another report back to next committee as an update, and I'll ensure that we make some comment about vegetative changes and to what degree that might have increased sediment load or whatever.
Right.
As to land management plan, I don't know whether there are land management plans here, but we can cover that off at the same time in terms of how that is managed in terms of cover and sediment supply.
Thank you, because it must be quite a concern, you know, for farmers and things like that.
Thank you. Councillor Bell.
Yeah, I'd have to agree that I've heard the similar comments that Councillor Hope has also heard. But I think in that particular instance, that downpour and that amount of water flattened the tussocks anyhow, but that is some of the concerns that some of the public do have, is that that new broken-in country, the speed of water speeds off that a lot quicker than what it did before it was developed. And that was probably a good question of Councillor Hope's to ask about the amendments.
Yeah.
Okay, any other queries? If not, Councillor Hope and Councillor Bell, would you like to move and second the report?
Happy to do that.
Thank you. The report is received and noted. Any discussion? If not, I'll put the motion. All those in favour, please say aye.
Aye.
Against, carried. Now, there's no item 12, notice of motions that I'm aware of, and so we've got to the closure of the meeting.